Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The year of 2019 is coming to a close, and with it comes the day most Americans set aside as a day for Thanksgiving. As I let my mind wander beyond the steel bars and concrete walls, I try to imagine what the people who live outside the prison gates are doing and what they're thinking. Do they ever think of the indigenous people who were forced from their homelands? Do they understand that with every step they take, no matter the direction, that they are walking on stolen land? Can they imagine, even for 1 minute, what it was like to watch the suffering of the women, the children and babies, and yes, the sick and elderly, as they were made to keep pushing west in freezing temperatures with little or no food? These were my people, and this was our land. There was a time when we enjoyed freedom and were able to hunt buffalo and gather the foods and sacred medicines. We were able to fish and we enjoyed the clean, clear water. My people were generous. We shared everything we had, including the knowledge of how to survive the long, harsh winters or the hot, humid summers. We were appreciative of the gifts from our Creator and remembered to give thanks on a daily basis. We had ceremonies and special dances that were a celebration of life. With the coming of foreigners to our shores, life, as we knew it, would change drastically. Individual ownership was foreign to my people. Fences, unheard of back then. We were a communal people, and we took care of each other. Our grandparents weren't isolated from us. They were the wisdom keepers and storytellers, and were an important link in our families. The babies, they were and are our future. Look at the brilliant young people who put themselves at risk, fighting to keep our water and environment clean and safe for the generations yet to come. They're willing to confront the giant multinational corporations by educating the general public of the devastation being caused. I smile with hope when I think of them. They're fearless and ready to speak the truth to all who are willing to listen. We also remember our brothers and sisters of Bolivia who are rioting in support of the first indigenous president, Evo Morales. His commitment to the people, the land, their resources, and protection against corruption is commendable. We recognize and identify with that struggle so well. So today, I thank all the people who are willing to have an open mind. Those who are willing to accept the responsibility of planning for 7 generations ahead. those who remember the sacrifices made by our ancestors so we can continue to speak our own language, practice our own way of thankfulness in our own skin, and that we always acknowledge and respect the indigenous lineage that we carry. For those of you who are thankful, you have enough food to feed your families. Please give to those who aren't as fortunate. If you're warm and have a comfortable shelter to live in, please give to those who are cold and homeless. If you see someone hurting and in need of a kind word or two, be that person who steps forward and lends a hand. And especially when you see injustice anywhere, please be brave enough to speak up to confront it. I want to thank all those who are kind enough to remember me and my family in your thoughts and prayers. Thank you for continuing to support and believe in me. There isn't a minute in any day that passes without me hoping that this will be the day I will be granted freedom. I long for the day when I can smell clean, fresh air, when I can feel a gentle breeze in my hair, witness the clouds as their movement hides the sun, and when the moon shines the light on the path to the sacred Inipi. That would truly be a day I could call a day of thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. My spirit is there with you, Duksha. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, you have been listening to the words of Leonard Peltier. It has been my pleasure to share them with you. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And I would like to say right here that one of the mistakes the Negro press makes and has been making has been sitting in your office waiting for the white man to write something about black people in his paper, and then you pick up his paper and rewrite it in your paper. The crime that you commit is, as a Negro reporter, when you rewrite what the white man has said about your own kind, you don't have intelligence enough to separate the truth from the falsehood.
Garth Reeves Sr. died this week. He was 100 years old and spent his life fighting racism with his journalism. Garth Reeves was owner and publisher of the Miami Times, a newspaper started by his father. The Times earned a reputation as the voice of Black Miami and was recognized in 2011 as the top black newspaper in the country by the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Mohammed Hamalyuddin is former managing editor of the Miami Times and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Miami is among those many American cities that have been the scene of civil unrest at one time or another over the past few decades. What are some of the stories that you remember that Garth Reeves and his newspaper were able to do?
Well, the stories had to do basically with politics and relationship between the police and the community. A lot of the folks, the police were white. And the African-American community did not think that the officers, long before you had Black Lives Matter, that they had any regard for the lives of African-Americans in Miami. McDuffie was the name of an insurance salesman. He was riding his motorcycle, and he passed some cops, and he gave them the finger. And those cops chased him down, stopped him, and beat him to death. They were charged. The case was taken out of Miami. I think it was tried before an all-white jury, and they were found not guilty. And that is when you had an uprising, a disturbance, a riot, people call it.
I gather Garth Reeves Sr. was very careful to refer to what happened not just as riots, but as protests.
Yes. Yes, the paper did not use the language of riots. The paper used the word uprising or civil disobedience. People did start to take action after this started to happen and, you know, pay attention, and they started to do things about making it, you know, safer for African-American community.
He really believed that the newspaper, the Miami Times, had a mission, didn't it?
When that newspaper started in 1923, I think there was no voice. There was nothing for the African-American community. Gartreaves decided he was going to change all of that when he came back from the war. And he found that he laid his life on the line for the country, and the country owed him. When he came back, he was still on the back of the bus. And he decided that this was going to be a voice for the community. And he wanted it also to be a place where they can exchange news among themselves, learn about themselves. One of the very big sections of the Miami Times when I was there was the obituaries, you know, people learning who died and who didn't die. And some people were allowed to write columns in the Miami Times expressing views. And these are all part of the tradition I carried on.
He was also involved in a Supreme Court case, wasn't he?
Yeah, the city of Miami owned a golf course in the late 1949, and the city allowed African-American citizens to play golf only on Mondays, and the Mondays were when the course was watered, so the African-American players had to play when it was being watered. So they sued the city, and they went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did rule in their favor that the city could not tax people and then deny them the right to use facilities that were being paid for by taxpayer dollars.
What do you think we can take from what the Reeves family did to contribute to the community?
I think Gart Reeves was very sharply focused to try to get African-American communities to see that, you know, they have a role to play to develop themselves, that they should go after jobs and get money. He said that being poor is no fun. Being rich is better. He wanted the African-American community to go after education. He wanted the white community to treat African-American community as equals, integrating the school system. And all of these things came to pass during Gart Reeves' tenure at the Miami Times.
Mohammed Hamal-Yudin, former managing editor of the Miami Times, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Now, it might sound like something from a science fiction movie, but robot dogs are being tested by police in the United States. They're made by a firm called Boston Dynamics, which has named its mechanical canine Spot. And the Massachusetts State Police are trying out these robots in a wide range of duties, as technology journalist Brian Heater explains.
TechCrunch, the publication that I work for, had an event back in April. We had the founder and CEO, Mark Raybert, on stage showing all of the different things that the Spot robots could potentially do. Ones that we got a bit of a glimpse of during this event was that the Massachusetts State Police was testing these in some demos. It was showing the robot's ability to open and close doors and was suggesting that these could potentially be used for some kind of high stress scenarios, things of that nature. Every time a new technology comes out and is used by the police, it tends to raise some, and understandably so, tends to raise some red flags with civil rights groups like the ACLU. It could be used for like a standoff situation. You know, it could be used if the police come into contact with somebody with a weapon or something of that nature. One of the applications for these robots is warehouse fulfillment. So Boston Dynamics has another robot called Handle, which they also showed off on our stage last year. It's, again, like this robot is incredibly sophisticated and is able to use a visioning system to determine the locations of packages, pick them up, and move them on and off of conveyor belts. And that's an application that we're absolutely seeing out in the world right now. Amazon has a number of these deployed out there. There's a bunch of other companies, Fetch Robotics. We're seeing that side. We're seeing warehouse fulfillment. We're seeing a lot of automation. We're seeing robots be used in assembly and factories, things like that. But I think it's safe to say that RoboCop is still a ways off.
U.S. technology journalist Brian Heater.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Arr! Arr! Huh! War and crimes. The two came to a head this weekend with a divide between the military and the commander-in-chief. William Brangham has the story.
At the center of all of this is the case of Chief Petty Officer Edward Gallagher, a highly decorated Navy SEAL. Previously, he was accused of murdering a wounded ISIS militant in Iraq in 2017 and of shooting at civilians. A court-martial acquitted him on those charges, but did convict him of posing in a photograph with the dead militant's body. Gallagher was demoted for that. But the controversy since then has been whether the Navy should mete out any further punishment, like whether he should keep his coveted status as a Navy SEAL and keep the emblem of that force, a pin showing an eagle carrying a trident and a musket. The president has routinely championed Gallagher and said that he would not allow the Navy to punish Gallagher anymore. And then, last night, the Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, was forced out of his post by the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, over his handling of Gallagher's case. Here to walk us through this controversy is Nancy Youssef. She's a national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
Great to be with you.
Gallagher's case is over, but then Rear Admiral Green, who oversees the Navy SEALs, decides he wants to have Gallagher out of the service. He doesn't want him to be a SEAL anymore. Pick up the story from there.
Well, what he wants is to say that the military should review whether Chief Gallagher should have the distinction and the honor of being called a Navy SEAL after this case. And so he calls for a review board, and that's where peers come forward, look at the case, and decide whether he should be able to keep something called the Trident Pin, which sort of signifies publicly and on your uniform that you are a member of one of the most elite forces in the United States military. And I think that's what Admiral Green was trying to get at with this review process. And that, after the fact that the president had restored his rank and brought back his pay, was sort of the last outstanding issue vis-a-vis this case.
And so then how did, explain the process by which the Secretary of the Navy is out?
And so what happened was there was real concern within the United States military leadership about the prospect of restoring Chief Gallagher's rank and of pardoning two other service members who were also accused of committing war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The feeling was that once you did that and had an outside intervention, it potentially threatened the sanctity of sort of good order and discipline that is so critical to the military. And the other fear was that if the U.S. didn't prosecute those accused of killing civilians in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, it would send a negative message to key partners. And so he was his rank restored, and Secretary Spencer was among those who was really against the outside intervention.
So the Navy Secretary is pushed out by the Secretary of Defense, and in his letter sort of acknowledging his resignation, he says this, quote, "I cannot in good conscience obey an order that I believe violates the sacred oath I took." But the Secretary of Defense's problem, it seems, with the Secretary of the Navy was something other. It was about a back channel he was doing with the White House. Can you explain that?
Sure. So the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, came out today and said that the U.S. military leadership had agreed that they would allow the process over his Trident Pin to proceed, and that he learned 2 days ago that Secretary Spencer had tried to come up with a back channel deal in which the Chief Gallagher would be allowed to keep his pin regardless of the findings of the panel. And Secretary Esper said that he lost confidence in Secretary Spencer because he was usurping the existing process.
And in the middle of all of this, of course, then Eddie Gallagher goes on Fox News, which has been his champion all along and championed his case from when he was back in the brig all the way through to his,
that's right,
his court-martial. And Gallagher is kind of remarkably very, very critical of some of his superiors. Let's take a listen to what he said.
"This is all about ego and retaliation. This has nothing to do with good order and discipline. They could have taken my trident at any time they wanted. Now they're trying to take it after the president restored my rank."
Later in that same interview, he went on to specifically, by name, criticize his superior officer, Rear Admiral Green. I mean, for people who don't appreciate this, how unusual is it for a sailor to say those things about his commanding officer?
It's extraordinarily unusual because there's a chain of command, and you're not allowed to criticize your superior in a one-on-one setting within your company, your unit, and let alone on Fox News. But I think it really gets at how much this case depended on him becoming a cause celeb on Fox News, John Hannity had taken a personal interest in. But for that, it's not clear that this case would have gotten the kind of attention that it did.
Lastly, what are you hearing amongst the military community more broadly about this particular case? Does this have a lasting impact, or is this just a one and done?
No, I think it does have a lasting impact. Like most things around this case, it's become very polarized. You hear people look at Chief Gallagher as either a war hero or a war criminal. You hear about concerns about the enduring impact of what happens when the military justice system can be undone with outside intervention. There are concerns that perhaps other service members will come forward and ask for an outside intervention and seek to undo the rulings of the military court system. And so there's a real wait-and-see approach in terms of what the after-effects are, the second- and third-order effects. There's an expectation that they will happen. And yet there are those who think that this was the president's prerogative, his right to do, and all falls within the proper chain of command. And so, like most things around this case, it has led to really polarized reactions even within the Pentagon.
Nancy Youssef of The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We do more before 9 a.m. than most people do all day.
Hey, First Sergeant. Good morning.
You can do it in the Army.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare is one of the most anticipated video game releases of the fall.
The rules of engagement have changed.
The game leads players through military missions and combat.
If you can't identify the target, you are the target.
So, it makes sense that Army recruiters picked this game to be the centerpiece of a recent recruiting event at an esports arena in Lakewood, a suburb outside of Denver. It's a dark room the size of a warehouse, lit mainly by the glow from rows and rows of computer screens. The people playing wear headphones. You hear the excited chatter of players and controllers clicking. Anyone who came to the game's release party was able to play the new game, as long as they also spoke to Army recruiters.
This is the targeted, you know, demographic, you know, these young men and women that come out here to play the esports.
Sergeant Vincent Cruz is a recruiter. He says video games are a way for the Army to connect with more people. It even started a professional esports team, which has become part of his pitch.
Reach out to these men and women and show them actually, hey, you can actually do this in the Army and get paid, by the way.
The Army has been struggling to attract new soldiers. Last year, it fell 6,000 troops short of its national recruiting goal. This year, the Army set a lower goal and met it. But Crew says the old ways to attract potential recruits just aren't working the way they used to.
Phone calls and, you know, text messages is not, you know, the way to go. Traditionally, that's how we've been trying to reach out to the population. For here, it's very difficult, you know what I mean? So now it's more like the Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat.
The Army says it's opened 44 virtual recruiting stations that are trying to reach potential soldiers through social media and text. And it calls its esports efforts some of the highest lead-generating events in the history of the all-volunteer force.
Do it! No, it's
Across the gaming arena, 17-year-old Gavin Gaines is sitting at one of the computers, staring at the bright screen. How is he doing so far?
I've died like 4 times in 3 missions, so not going to say greatest.
Gaines says he isn't ready for college yet, and he's about 95% sure he wants to go to the military. A big reason for him is community.
It's always just kind of been a big motivator for me, is just kind of like having somewhere where I belong. I like the military because it's like, you may not even necessarily like everyone, but it's like, you know, they have your back type of thing.
Out of about 110 people that attended the esports event, the military says it gained 35 leads. Michelle Alcantar is also 17 and a brand new recruit. She'll graduate in December, and by the summer, she's off to boot camp in Oklahoma. She got into video games through her brother-in-law, who's also in the Army. Call of Duty is a favorite. Both gaming and the military are stereotypically guy things, but she's proud to be a woman doing both of them.
To me, it's really special because not a lot of women, I feel like, are represented in the Army, and I feel like it's such a power move for women just because, like, we can do the same thing men can, and we're finally allowed to do that after I know that years that we couldn't.
Alcantar also ended up winning a raffle that night. She went home with a copy of the new game for Xbox, but she didn't say whether she'll take it to boot camp with her. In Denver, I'm Taylor Allen.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Federal authorities say domestic terrorism is one of the top national security threats facing the country. In just the last few years, we've seen major attacks by white supremacists. They've targeted Jewish people in Pittsburgh, Latinos in El Paso, African Americans in Charleston, just to name a few. And many say the government still hasn't taken this threat seriously enough. NPR's Embedded podcast has been telling the story of one case, a case that shows just how easily the government can let a dangerous white supremacist slip through the cracks. Tom Dreisbach is an investigative reporter for Embedded. He joins us now. Hey, Tom.
Hi.
So this case that you looked into, I know that it starts way back in the 1970s and it goes up to basically the present day. How did it all begin?
Well, it starts with a man named Frazier Glenn Miller, who goes by the name Glenn. He was a combat veteran of the Vietnam War, and after the war, he lived in North Carolina and got deeply involved in the white power movement.
White power!
Miller was the head of a group called the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and he and his group were accused of harassing African Americans with cross burnings and death threats, training a racist paramilitary militia, and even stealing heavy weaponry from a U.S. military base, including anti-tank weapons.
Uh-huh.
And the goal of all of this, he said, was to prepare for a race war.
How do you even steal from the U.S. military?
Well, he had sympathizers in the military. He, of course, was a military veteran himself. And together they were able to gather this weaponry from Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
Wow. Okay, so this guy is stealing from the U.S. military. He's threatening to kill Americans with these weapons. Did the government do anything to try to stop him?
Well, according to people who were there at the time, at least at first, the government did not take Miller's threats seriously enough. One of the people he was accused of harassing was named Bobby Person. Bobby Person was an African-American prison guard, and he says he was repeatedly threatened by Miller's group. He and his family faced death threats, cross burnings, and he told me that whenever Miller's group came by his house, he would call the police, but the police never came.
I just had to carry a weapon everywhere I went, you know, to protect myself and stay up at night to protect my family, because I know I wasn't going to get no help from the sheriff's department.
Bobby Person eventually did get help. The Southern Poverty Law Center, the civil rights group, heard about his case, got involved. They sued Miller, and they presented evidence along with federal prosecutors, and they were able, together with those prosecutors, to get a court order to force Miller to disband his paramilitary group.
Okay, so he was forced to break up the group, but did that stop Glenn Miller?
Well, at this point, he goes underground. He issues what he calls a declaration of war, and he declares it on people of color, on Jewish Americans, on federal judges. He records it at one point and sends it to newspapers and radio stations.
We have the necessary material to begin this revolution. If these demands are not accepted within 48 hours, the war will begin shortly thereafter.
But federal agents track him down to a trailer park in Ozark, Missouri. They fire tear gas and force him to surrender, and they find him with a massive arsenal of explosives, grenades, guns that have been illegally converted to fully automatic. But then, at this point, and this is one of the most surprising parts of the story, federal authorities offer him a deal.
What?
They offer him a 5-year prison sentence in return for him testifying against some of the leading white supremacist groups in the country.
Only 5 years. Wow.
Only 5 years. But here's the kicker, all the people he testified against were acquitted on all charges by all white juries. So this case that he was instrumental in was ultimately a massive failure for the government.
That just blows me away. I mean, I want to say things are different now. That was back in the late 80s. What makes this case resonate? What makes it important today?
Well, after receiving that five-year prison sentence, that five-year deal, he only served 3 years. Wow. And rather than changing his views in prison, if anything, his views became more hardened than ever. By the 2000s, he became very active on racist forums. He praised a racist serial killer and even a white supremacist terrorist attack in Norway. And then in 2014, he went to a Jewish community center in Overland Park, Kansas, and he killed three people himself. Mm. His victims were Reet Underwood, who was 14 years old. There was William Corcoran, who was 69 years old and Reet Underwood's grandfather. And then there was Teresa Lamano, who was 53 years old. And Glenn Miller said explicitly at the time that his motivation was to terrorize Jewish people. He readily admitted to the murders, and ultimately he was tried and sentenced to death. And he is still on death row pending appeal.
But given his past criminal history before this horrific crime where he killed these three people, was the government watching him pretty closely because he had this record?
Well, that question went to the top FBI agent in the area at that time, Special Agent Michael Cast. He was asked by reporters the day after the attack if Miller was on their radar.
We are aware of his existence. We are aware that he was arrested. We are aware that he was affiliated with certain hate groups. The answer is yes, but beyond that, I really can't comment on it.
Were you watching him recently then?
No, I can tell you that, no.
They were not watching him recently in the time before the attack. I wanted to ask them why they were not watching Miller, given his criminal history and his violent rhetoric. And both the FBI and the Department of Justice declined to comment. And experts told me, bottom line, it is incredibly difficult to figure out why they were not watching him, given his very serious criminal record.
Right. But I also get why it's such a hard call, that there is this tension between trying not to jump on someone's speech. Obviously, people have freedom of speech, but also trying to prevent horrific crimes. So what does the Glenn Miller case say more broadly about how the federal government prosecutes white supremacist terrorism specifically?
Well, in general, experts told me the government simply has not prioritized investigations of white supremacist violence. The FBI over the summer said while they are making it a top priority, that 80% of the resources for FBI terrorism cases are going to international terrorism, into groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and 20% is going into domestic terrorism.
Only 20. That's
and
amazing.
And a lot of experts say that ratio is out of whack, and that in the case of Glenn Miller, he was a domestic terrorist, and for years he had told people what he was going to do, and then he did it.
Yeah.
But I talked to Kathleen Ballou. She is a professor at the University of Chicago, and she has studied the white power movement extensively, and here's what she told me.
For many of them, this is a matter of faith. They're talking about what they're doing as preventing the apocalypse of the white race, and the idea that any amount of incarceration could undo that ideology is just, there's no reason to think anyone would stop believing that.
So in other words, you know, with an ideology of hate, there's no way you can just arrest your way out of this problem.
God, such an interesting, disturbing story. That is NPR's Tom Dreisbach of the podcast Embedded. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Elsa.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
The federal government says domestic terrorism is a top national security threat, and it's on the rise. So what happens when extremist views come up in schools? For the Embedded podcast, Kelly McEvers reports on how teachers are coping with an increase in white nationalist incidents. And just a warning, this story contains reporting on racist and bigoted language and ideas.
Derek Weimer taught high school in Kentucky, in a suburb just outside Cincinnati, Ohio. A few years ago, he was teaching a world history class, and one of his students, who was white, would talk about how much he liked Adolf Hitler and the Nazis.
He believed that, you know, the white race was the most dominant, most powerful race.
Derek, who is also white, thought, it's a free country. The student can believe what he wants. So I will try to change his mind with facts. He told the student how Nazis sent children to fight and what Allied soldiers found when they liberated the death camps. But still, the student didn't change his mind. The student told Derek he believed what he read on white nationalist websites like Stormfront.
I remember saying that's garbage. That's Nazi garbage. I approached it as a teacher would approach it. My weapon was logic. My weapon was compassion. My weapon was morality, right and wrong.
The student eventually graduated, and one day, a few years later, Derek got a message on Facebook from another former student.
It was like, hey, he was like, follow this link, and you won't believe who's involved. And sure enough, I mean, you know, there it was.
Let's get right to our breaking news out of Charlottesville, Virginia.
White nationalists joined by the KKK, neo-Nazis.
At least one person is dead, more than two dozen others hurt after a car slammed into a group of demonstrators.
James Alex Field Jr. of Ohio was charged with second-degree murder along with...
James Fields, who killed Heather Heyer at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, was Derek's former student, the neo-Nazi.
I was shocked. And I got kind of a sick feeling to my stomach.
Derek says he has no idea if he could have stopped James Fields from committing violence. But knowing what he knows now, he says, he wishes he'd done more.
I'd have been more aggressive in making sure it was properly reported. You know, I'd report it to the administration. I'd report it to the guidance counselors. And I would also mention it to the school resource officer.
While a lot of teachers, like Derek, might not know that these hateful ideas can lead to violence, other teachers are working hard to spread the word.
My name is Nora Flanagan. I am an English teacher in the Chicago Public Schools.
One day, several years back, Nora Flanagan saw a white student with a patch on his jacket. A patch she recognized was a logo for a movement called White Pride Worldwide, basically a square cross inside a circle.
You know, I stopped him and struck up a conversation and asked him, you know, what was going on with his new look. And he seemed really excited that I had asked. And he sprung back with, there's nothing wrong with pride in being white.
And what did you say?
I remember at the time feeling really stressed and scrambled to respond in a way that kept him engaged in conversation, didn't shut it down. But I also wanted to make clear to him that I knew what that patch meant.
She didn't want to shut him down, she says, because she knew that could push him further toward the movement by reinforcing the white nationalist narrative that white people are oppressed.
Over the years, white nationalist groups have provided instructions for young people to bring their ideology into school. I had to run on the assumption that this student was ready for anything I might say and might even be looking to escalate the conversation. So my goal was to stay calm because overreacting is just as counterproductive as underreacting.
Nora went to the discipline office of her school. She says the white dean she reported it to seemed confused and unfamiliar with the issue.
Especially in the early 2000s, if a kid didn't have a giant swastika on his back, then I needed to do some convincing.
The dean asked for more information, so Nora went online and found the student's patch in the Anti-Defamation League's glossary of hate symbols.
And brought it to them with the symbol circled.
She told administrators, we need to do something. Now.
The administration finally concluded that it was worth searching his locker, where they found a stack of printed recruitment flyers for the National Alliance, which at the time was still a prominent hate group in this country. And they also found sketches in his notebooks of people hanging from trees.
black people specifically. Nora says she doesn't know if the student was planning to commit violence, but what they found in that locker made it feel very possible.
I felt terrified. I felt heartbroken that a kid was this far down a really hateful path. But I also felt immensely relieved that we knew what we knew before anything terrible had happened.
The school connected the student with counseling and talked to his parents. And eventually, Nora says, he disengaged from the white nationalist movement.
And I think that part of the reason that he turned out all right was that we didn't underreact, we didn't overreact, and we remembered that as terrifying as the situation felt, we did still have, you know, a student, a human child at the center of it.
These days, Nora says it's even harder to know when a student is interested in white nationalism, when a lot of this stuff happens online and the ideas are presented as memes and jokes. She says students are using white nationalist avatars in school materials, posting white nationalist quotes on social media, using white nationalist talking points in research papers. Nora and some other teachers she knew recently wondered, where's the handbook on how to deal with all this stuff?
These incidents were happening at my own school, at friends and former colleagues' schools, but nobody had a set way to respond.
So she and two other teachers decided to write the handbook. It's actually called The Toolkit for Confronting White Nationalism in Schools, a 50-page guide with specific examples of extremist incidents and how to respond to them. And their advice to students is to document incidents when they happen and report them to at least two adults. And to schools, to offer a private way for students and staff to report these incidents and make it clear in public that hate is not acceptable ever. The problem, Nora says, is that for schools and parents, it's still difficult to get them to take this stuff seriously. She says she often hears stuff like, this is just political correctness, or racism is over, or what about free speech? And here's how she says schools should respond.
All ideologies are not equal. They do not deserve equal airtime, and they do not deserve equal protection. I believe in free speech. I love free speech. However, speech that threatens violence, speech that advocates expulsion or extermination of groups of people, is not protected in our school communities because it endangers our school communities.
Nora says, sadly, the more extremist attacks that happen around the country, the more likely it is parents and school administrators will take this stuff seriously.
These conversations about the dangers of white nationalist ideology, unfortunately, become easier with every mass shooting committed by a white nationalist.
The Toolkit for Confronting White Nationalism in Schools has been presented at dozens of conferences and at least 10 schools and has been distributed to thousands of people. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
You can download the toolkit at westernstatescenter.org.
Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
This is New England Public Radio News. Late last month, five swastikas were found written in chalk on a building at UMass Amherst. A week before that, Smith College in Northampton discovered swastikas on campus. Visiting Smith professor Loretta Ross has been taking on neo-Nazis for decades, and after the swastika incident, Ross gave her students an unexpected lesson on choosing the right opponents. New England Public Radio's Ben James has the story.
Back in the 1990s, Loretta Ross was working at the Center for Democratic Renewal, a national anti-hate group, when she received a call from a man named Floyd Cochran.
And immediately, without even thinking, I blurted out, "The Floyd Cochran?" Because we monitored him. He was the national spokesman for the Aryan Nations.
To Ross's surprise, Cochran was seeking help. One of his sons had been born with a cleft palate, and a leader of the Aryan Nations argued that the child should be put to death. In the process of deprogramming Cochran's radical beliefs, Ross and Cochran became friends.
Floyd taught me a lot about the construction of whiteness and white supremacy in a way that I had not shown any sympathy or empathy for heretofore, because I kind of felt like if they wanted to hate me, I was okay hating them. Yeah.
Flash forward a couple decades, and this black feminist leader now teaches a course on white supremacy to a few dozen students, most of them white, at Smith College.
I like teaching young people how to subvert white supremacy without feeling guilty over being white.
On a recent Tuesday, Ross looked to her students for clarification on some disturbing campus events.
Didn't this campus just experience an anti-Semitic incident while I was out of town? What happened?
Swastikas drawn in red Sharpie on the walls of three campus buildings. Students told Ross the story, and almost immediately they described the campus response.
It was really hard to hear some of the knee-jerk reactions of excuses. The idea that it couldn't have been a Smith student.
Other students said the school administration mishandled the racist graffiti.
Smith has such a long history of only responding, like, retroactively and doing nothing proactively.
Ross listened closely for a few minutes until finally she'd heard enough.
I don't want to distract y'all from what is a student human right, which is to bash your university. But
free speech.
Huh? Yes, yes. But let's be clear. Smith, at worst, is a problematic ally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're supposed to be talking about fascists. And so unless you think the leadership of Smith is fascist, can we stay focused on the fascist?
There's a term Ross uses again and again, threat assessment or target assessment. She says organizers and activists on the left can too easily overstate the harm caused by their potential allies, and that they often fail to accurately assess the risk posed by their true opponents.
So I want to advise students to have better target assessment. Go after the Nazis. Don't go after the people you think that should have better defended you from the Nazis. They may be a problem, but they're not the ones trying to exterminate you.
In a recent New York Times op-ed, and now in a book she's writing, Ross brings the question of target assessment to bear on a broader issue, the way people communicate dissent in what's often referred to as the call-out culture.
The call-out for me is when you choose to offer your judgment of someone else's thoughts, behaviors, or actions, or looks in a way that publicly humiliates and shames them.
Calling power holders to account for their actions is necessary, Ross says.
But most calling out that I criticize is horizontal. It's between people of the same power status or the same relative status that seek to prove how woke or how politically correct they are.
Maren Grasky, a student in Ross's course on white supremacy, now questions the ways that she herself has called people out.
I was thinking about the times I have via social media, which has never been fruitful. It has only made me angrier and has, like, usually resulted in being blocked or something and the person not changing their mind.
Ross's advice is to take the grievances off social media, to end the group pile-ons, meet with those you disagree with one-on-one, and begin the more challenging process of calling in.
Calling in is holding people accountable for things that they do that are problematic, but doing it in a way that is healing versus punishing.
You don't build movements by ruining relationships, Ross says. Her book, Calling in the Call-Out Culture, will be published in 2020. For New England Public Radio, I'm Ben James.
I have no fear when I say, and I say it every day, every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
But first at 6, the fallout from an ugly fight at a high school football game. Good evening. I'm Alan Campbell.
And I'm Carolyn Clifford. Police are investigating trouble that erupted in the stands after refs called a semifinal game between Detroit Denby and Almont.
7X News reporter Jim Cursor is live at Denby tonight. Jim, seems like a lot to sort through. Do police know who did what?
Officials at both schools are going through cell phone videos. The Oakland County Sheriff is also out there. They're also investigating. Nobody was injured. Nobody was arrested. But some are saying people in Almont use the N-word against Denby people.
A lot of trouble, a lot of chippiness.
The refs stopped the game with 3 minutes left and Almont winning 36-8. One Denby player was ejected earlier for a flagrant personal foul. He's suspended for one future game. Then it got ugly in the stands. Officials are looking at all unblurred videos to determine who did what. The superintendent in Elmont says adults in his group are a key focus.
The people that we would have expected to de-escalate the situation were instead taunting the student athletes from Denby.
The superintendent, his athletic director, and high school principal were all at the game. Superintendent says they're talking with students, players, and adults. Some of the people on the Denby side say Elmont people use the N-word against Denby.
We've watched a lot of videotapes, the ones that are public, the ones that aren't public yet. And you can't hear those kind of comments.
The superintendent in Elmont is reaching out to Detroit.
If they have evidence, if they have video evidence, or they can provide us direct information, we would love to hear it.
Oakland County called in Milford, Wixom, and Walled Lake police to the stadium in Walled Lake to end the melee. None of those departments has body cam videos.
It was totally ridiculous that something like that with children is still happening in 2019.
The superintendent in Detroit issued a statement that says, based on their preliminary findings, Elmont adult spectators were cursing and spitting on our coaches and players after the game. And the disrespect continued on social media, where Elmont fans used racist stereotypes. Social media posts with finger pointing on both sides have gone viral.
I think a lot of that has become hyperbole and exaggeration, and a lot of society's ills have been heaped onto this thing in a big hurry.
The teachable moment being that you must think before you act.
Now, anybody who's identified in these investigations would be banned from school events. The Oakland County Sheriff says there could be disorderly conduct or other charges. And for Elmont, they're going to play their first ever championship game this Saturday at Ford Field downtown. They will play Lansing Catholic. Live on the east side, Jim Kurtzner, 7 Action News.
And you just hate to see a video like that, a fight breaking out at a high school football game. Hopefully this investigation will uncover what happened.
Yeah, because no winners in this one. Certainly sad to see. Thank you, Jim.
Black babies cost less.
At least 1 in 7 mothers suffer from postpartum depression. Left untreated, this can have serious consequences for both moms and babies. The burden on women of color is especially heavy. They are 3 times more likely to experience postpartum depression and are also less likely to get treatment for it. Nina Feldman at member station WHYY in Philadelphia has our story.
Santino Adams is a talkative and precocious 2-year-old.
Yeah, Bible.
Umbrella, right.
The rain.
Yes, the rain.
Rain one clouds.
He's at home playing with his mom, Stephanie Lee, on their living room floor in Philadelphia. Santino is Lee's 2nd son, and he was a surprise. At 37, she thought she was done raising kids.
Like, I was busy. I was out. It's like almost like I felt like Stella got her groove back. I got my groove back.
But even when she found out she was pregnant, Lee thought she could keep her momentum going.
I thought I was going to be able to work out until my 9th month and work up until my 9th. Like, I was like, I'm going to be in labor at work.
But about 5 months into her pregnancy, Lee had a procedure to prevent her from going into an unsafe early labor. It forced her to stay on bed rest.
It was so rough. Like, I was a mess. Like, I was crying.
Lee was stressed. She was worried about money and didn't feel like her friends or family understood what she was going through. The depression continued after Santino was born, too, but Lee felt embarrassed to ask for help.
The Black community don't know postpartum. It's like they look at it like, you need to be strong, girl. Like, my aunts and all of them went through, had 5, 6, 7 babies, and they all about 2, 3 years apart. Like, you only got one, and it's this expectation on us as women of color that, like, we have to be, like, these superhero strong, that we're not allowed to be vulnerable. I'm not allowed to have postpartum because I'm Black.
Underreporting of postpartum depression and the fear of being judged is pretty common for lots of women. But 27-year-old Ariel Dickey says that as a Black woman, she had another concern when she thought about asking for help. She also struggled with postpartum depression and was afraid her newborn daughter would be taken from her.
She's like so sweet and nurturing, like, whoa. Like, if she sees me a little sad, she'll say, what's wrong? And she'll grab my face and kiss it.
After her maternity leave, Dickie went back to work. The separation felt overwhelming.
Sometimes I would be with my, like, talking to my boss and things, and I would have, like, this impulse of, like, I quit, you know, just because... To me, in that moment, it's like my time here isn't worth me being away from her.
That feeling lasted months. Dickie knew it was more than separation anxiety, but didn't dare utter the words postpartum depression.
I was scared because it's just like, what if they think I'm like a danger to us? Oh, wait. Postpartum depression, that means you might, like, you want to harm yourself and the baby, you know, like, that whole thing.
Dickie says she worried that admitting she had depression would trigger a call to child welfare.
It's something that I've seen happen, like, seen growing up, hearing stories of moms that, you know, like, they had their kid in, like, the most loving home and, like, for the slightest thing. Now you're under investigation, you know. It just didn't seem like a risk I was willing to take.
Her fears are warranted. Research shows child welfare workers judge black mothers as unfit at a higher rate than white mothers, even when they have the same education and income level. It can also be harder to detect postpartum depression in women of color because they were mostly excluded when the screening tools were being created.
And so what we're stuck with is tools that weren't necessarily developed with these cultural nuances in mind.
That's psychiatrist Alfie Breland-Noble. She says screeners often ask questions using keywords like depression or anxiety, but different communities use different language.
So they'll say, I have the blues, I'm in my feelings, I don't feel right, something feels off. We have this old saying among Southern African Americans where people will say nothing ain't wrong, but something ain't right. You know what I mean? So it's just this uneasiness. So those are the kinds of things I've encountered with people where they will sort of talk around depression, but nobody really wants to say that what they have is a mental illness like depression.
Even if women of color show signs of depression, getting treatment means even more challenges. Stacey Callum is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. During the baby's first year, she screens new mothers for postpartum depression at each visit. If signs point to a problem, Callum refers them to mental health services. But once she had her own kid, she wondered, are the moms really going?
Literally just bundling up your child and leaving the house is an accomplishment in that immediate postpartum phase.
Callum did some research and found that in the 6 months after being diagnosed, only 1 in 10 mothers got any kind of treatment.
So first, you have to get yourself to the appointment. You have to arrange for childcare. And then on top of all of that, you might have depression. I mean, of course it's hard. Of course so many mothers aren't receiving services. The system isn't set up to be easy for them.
Eventually, both the Philadelphia moms, Stephanie Lee and Arielle Dickie, were able to get treatment. Lee's counselor actually came to her house, so it felt private and easy.
I don't know if words can like really describe how much it really did help me. And I think there needs to be like a campaign of like a bunch of faces of women of color that look like us so they know like I went through it too.
Treatment for postpartum depression is effective. Talk therapy and antidepressants usually work. The hardest part for most new moms is getting the help. For NPR News, I'm Nina Feldman in Philadelphia.
This story was reported in partnership with Aneri Patani of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation?
Family sizes have been steadily shrinking around the industrialized world for decades, and Italy is a prime example. Just a generation ago, 4 children was the norm. Today, the average family has fewer than 2. And as special correspondent Christopher Livesay reports from Sicily, demographers warn that the shrinking population could drag the country into an unprecedented economic crisis.
Little Saverio is just 13 days old, born here in the Sicilian town of Nicosia.
It's special.
It's special for the hospital, and it's very, very special to us.
Special to them because it's their first child. Special to the hospital because he's the only newborn here. The birth rate here is so low, the maternity ward has risked closing, says Dr. Maria Rosaria Vena, who oversees it.
It's a bit sad to see all these empty beds, because when there aren't any births, we feel like we're wasting hours of our time.
How many births were there last year in total?
about 200 births, whereas when I started working here 20 years ago, there were about 400 every year.
So just in the span of 20 years, half of the births have gone.
Yes, that's why there's always the risk they could shut us down. To justify a maternity ward, you have to have a minimum 500 annual births. But the nearest other hospital is a very long and difficult drive away. If they closed this hospital, some mothers would end up giving birth on the side of the road.
Across the hall, I meet 20-year-old Lorena Scrifignano, the only expectant mother in the ward.
I don't have any friends who are pregnant. It's really hard to raise a family. I don't have a job, and the father has to drive an hour and 30 minutes to work. So he's going to be away a lot, and my child isn't going to have many friends his own age.
It's a scene repeating itself across Italy. Census figures show the national population is steadily shrinking, the first time that's happened in 90 years, due in large part to the declining birth rate. The average Italian family today only has 1.2 children, says Angelo Mazza, a professor of demographics at the University of Catania in Sicily.
There's that idea of the Italian family with lots of kids. I mean, what could be more Italian than that?
I'll tell you that fertility rates have been going down from the mid-60s. To replace the population, every woman should make at least two babies during her life. I mean, that's logic. And 1.2 is kind of far from two.
So why are Italians just not having as many children as they used to?
Well, it is not because they don't want to. They feel that conditions are not good enough to have two babies because you need to get a job, a proper job. And it may happen that this does not give you enough time to fulfill your wishes, your reproductive wishes.
Italy's economy has been reeling since the 2008 global economic crisis. The youth unemployment rate stands at a staggering 35%, prompting young people to both hold off on starting a family and leave in search of work. Last year, more than 150,000 Italians emigrated abroad. Factor in the plunge in pregnancies, and you have the only major European economy with a population forecast to decline even further over the next 5 years. Take, for example, the town of Acquaviva Platani in Sicily. Today, it has only 800 inhabitants, down from roughly 3,700 in the 50s. Founded 4 centuries ago, the town's narrow streets and positioned high atop a hill once made it difficult for invaders to pillage. Today, young people find it difficult to live and work here, says Mayor Salvatore Caruso.
There's hardly any industry. A number of young people have gone to live in the north or abroad, either to study or to work. It's hard to imagine young couples coming here if they don't have work. Today, the majority of the population is elderly, so there are hardly any births.
So how many births are we talking about? Quindi quante nascite l'anno scorso, per esempio?
I believe last year there were 5 or 6, and we'll have around that this year, too.
Over the years, he says, vanishing families has meant shrinking class sizes, forcing them to combine age groups, and in some cases, close schools.
But if people aren't having children anymore, does your town run the risk of eventually dying?
There's a gap of 10 to 15 people every year between births and deaths, so it's certainly possible.
Walking the empty streets, I meet some of those few young people still living here. They all share the same part-time job, one of the few left in town, caretaking for the elderly.
It would be nice to raise a family in my hometown, but I don't know if I have a future here. I really think I'll have to leave. I don't want to see my town disappear, but in the end, we have to look out for ourselves.
Italy is second in the world only to Japan for having the highest concentration of senior citizens. If more young people leave, it's a vicious circle for the town and country.
If we have less children today, we're going to have less parents tomorrow and even less children and so forth, you know.
So what are some of the problems that we might run into?
Eventually, the population could extinguish. And when baby boomers retire, you're going to have a small amount of individuals taking care of a larger amount of old people. Things are going to be even worse in the next 10 or 20 years.
only 10 or 20 years. That's right around the corner.
Yes, that's the emergency. See?
It's an emergency.
It's an emergency, yes. It's a real emergency.
But solutions exist, he says. The government could incentivize childbirth, much as neighboring France has done, by investing more in daycare, longer parental leaves, and tax exemptions to parents.
They have now almost the same population than Italy does. You know that they have 65% more children every year there.
In France?
In France, yes, than in Italy.
65% more.
Yes, yes, yes.
The other solution, migrants. Mostly from sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia, they've been steadily arriving in Italy for years, offsetting much of the decline in population. Last year, however, Italy began to ban migrant ships and enact other measures to lower immigration to the country. If Italy continues to block migration from outside Europe, then half of the population will die out by the end of the century, according to the EU Statistics Agency. Back in Acquaviva Platani, Alessia Boscarini manages a cafe where she's recently given her shrinking town a bump of hope.
He's due in just a few weeks. His name is Alessandro, our first. It's very exciting because there are so few babies born from our town every year. This will only be the fifth this year. It's such a big event that the town rings the church bells every time a baby is born.
But with that birth several weeks away, the bells remain silent, as they have for most of the year. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Christopher Livesay in Acquaviva Platani, Sicily.
Angela Chapman says she and her family are victims of constant intimidation and verbal attacks. She says Esposito displayed the Confederate flag while her 12-year-old daughter waited for the school bus.
And other occasions where she had a friend over and he looked at them, opened up the flag, closed it, and walked away.
Lieutenant Eric Peterson says the harassment started over the summer.
The two neighbors got into a heated argument, and at some point, Esposito yelled to him, "You don't know who I am. I'll have the KKK here. Matter of fact, I'll have the KKK here on 4th of July."
He then began to talk about how he does not like black people, and he does not hear black people.
Police arrested Esposito in June with breach of peace. He was arrested again last week, charged with disorderly conduct.
This case was taken seriously. It was investigated, and you know, we worked with the state's attorney.
Neighbors say they're shocked.
I'm 90 years old, and I've been here for like over 50 years, and nothing like this has ever happened before.
We need significant change because, unfortunately, the mindsets are still there. Racism is still alive.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 30, 2019. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions you would like to share, if you have any interesting, I guess, counter-racist stories related to the so-called holidays, festivities from the week. Hopefully, if you did not have to be on the plantation, if you were able to spend time with other non-white people, so-called family, friends, and not be in conflict and not eat food that is going to kill you soon. That is awesome. If you could exchange views, awesome, or do some cleaning, constructive investment of time and energy. But if you have any, folks have any stories related to the so-called holidays you would like to share or other constructive tidbits, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Lots to discuss. We should be here tomorrow for Azur Savage. He have to double check with the pronouns. I know when Azur was at Elliott Bay, it was said transgender. That is definitely used, but I have to check in about the other pronouns to specify. But I am excited. I read You Failed Us, the book Azur Savage authored. 16-year-old Azur Savage authored right here, Seattle Public Schools, Garfield High School. The text deals primarily with white supremacy, racism, and how non-white students, especially black students, are mistreated, are not in the so-called gifted classes, how the few non-white students who are there are closer to the standard of whiteness. I think she said almost exclusively they'll have a white parent, the few non-white students who are there, like herself. Just had a lot of really interesting information. Cowbells there, not just because she has a white parent, but she, in the book, she described how this is in eighth grade, so we're talking like 13 years old. Maybe 12, maybe 14, somewhere in that area. But she said that these eighth grade white girls fetishized black boys. Now, that's something that we talk about quite a bit, but generally not from the perspective of 13-year-old white girls being engaged in this behavior. That's among other things. Like I said, lots of, you know, really interesting subject matter. In addition to the response to my question at Elliott Bay, they finally uploaded the audio to KUOW, Seattle Public Radio. It was unedited, as far as I could tell. It was the full session that I participated in. They included my question unedited. I obviously didn't get to ask it. We had to write our questions down and submit them, but my question was in the recording, read unedited. You can hear the audience response. The only thing is, and I don't think this is, you know, my memory failing me, because this was, you know, basically 2 weeks ago, this event. The recording, obviously, they have Azur Savage and Mr. Green, the black male who interviewed her. Obviously, the sound is optimized for their audio, not the audience. So you don't get to hear the same intensity of the audience response, but it is there. You can definitely hear the gasp and all of that around that question. But I mean, yeah, if the recording had been a little different, sometimes, you know, they do the sound recording so that you can hear the audience a little better. Whew, wow. But tomorrow, and it's a special time, victim of white supremacy, host of the Cows Yoga Program, freelance journalist, yoga instructor, vinyasa and prenatal. So I am teaching a yoga class tomorrow. I did not plan on teaching this class tomorrow. The program was scheduled, and then it was, oh, teaching? Think we can work it out. So it should be 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 5:30 p.m. Pacific. So just needed that extra 30-minute cushion so that I can get back from teaching, and then we'll be ready to roll. If you really want to be cool, if you're in the Seattle area, you can come take the class. We'll do a little yoga, and then bang, we'll go do the broadcast. Well, not we, but you can listen. I'll do the broadcast. It'll be, hey, I was just at the studio. Now I'm listening live. How crazy. But that should be tomorrow, Sunday, December 1. Looking forward to it. Azur Savage, again, the title of her book, You Failed Us. So many things to get to. Have my list here. I thought the segment on postpartum depression, I get to repeat myself, Vinyasa and prenatal certified yoga instructor. The segment on postpartum depression for black moms. I have, say, incongruous, conflicting thoughts. I totally believe that it's logical, and I have known black mothers who had a really tough time, were depressed, had a lot of anxiety, stress, both before and after the pregnancy, the labor specifically, which I totally understand. System of white supremacy, for everything that was outlined in that segment, for all of the reasons and more that you can imagine in a system. We had that, we read Richard Williams' autobiography, even though he's not a black mother, but he talked about when, I believe it was when Venus was being born. And he said he was in, he was at the hospital and he was outside the delivery room. His at the time wife, she's inside. And he said he was just screaming, thinking, oh, my God, what am I going to do if somebody calls my daughter, which I believe was Venus? What am I going to do if somebody calls her a nigger, which they have? Oh, my gosh. And he said he just started screaming and screaming and screaming. And he said he went back in to comfort his wife. And she said, did you hear that fool outside who was yelling? I hope they called security. And he said he was so embarrassed. He's like, oh, Lord, yeah, that was me. That was me. I don't remember if he said he, whether or not he told her in the book and why he was yelling. But that is one of many vivid moments in black and white, the way I see it. Richard Williams, The Cows Book Club. Reading is more important than watching television. So I certainly grasp. On the one hand, absolutely do I think black moms, stressed, anxiety, absolutely. Depression, absolutely. And we talked about it on the program, that nonsense of the black people are superheroes. Look at everything we've been through. John Henry, we are just, oh my goodness, slavery has made us so strong. Civil rights movement has made us so strong. I saw that's one of the most nauseating, loathsome images I can recall. It was an image and it had it was like the bowels of a slave ship, and it showed a bunch of individuals classified as black shackled together. And it said, look at everything that black people have gone through. We are the strongest people ever. I detest all of that. All of that. It's basically equating strength with how much punishment you can take, how much abuse you can take, not your ability to do anything, your ability to be abused and hang around, I guess. That is not helpful in a system of white supremacy for people who are going to be terrorized. That is not a healthy way of conceptualizing strength or power at all. And I think that that is extremely harmful. We hear that so often. Vernelia Randall said the exact same thing that I'm just saying. She said it more eloquently when we talked about her book, Dying While Black. That's also brought up in medical apartheid. Being abused does not make you healthier. It makes you sick. So I feel that way on the one hand, but then on the other hand, I'm conflicted because that's why I've been saying this for like 2 years now. Isn't that odd? Like it seems like there are a lot of these reports talking about, oh man, if you're a black mom, you're going to die in pregnancy. Oh man, if you're a black mom, it's the worst thing ever. Oh man, if you're a black mom, you're going to be, it just seems odd. Not that I'm saying it's not true or that I don't understand the logic of why that would be, but just if we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, and you could solve this problem, why just keep having these reports? And it doesn't seem like I've always seen these reports. This seems like a very recent thing of calling more attention to this or reporting this. I'm not sure. I just have some, I have questions about it. It's just, as I'm conflicted. I think it's important. I'm a prenatal instructor. I see the logic of that. I know black moms need assistance. But there does seem to be something peculiar about this subject being promoted. We've heard a number of them. That's why I try to play them often. And we've heard some people who said, hey, I don't think this is even true. I think this might just be racist propaganda. And there is a lot of that in the history of racism. We question everything. Mr. Fuller says that. Question everything. Next on the list. So they have the report. They're talking about white supremacy, racism. They talk about Frazier Glenn Miller, the race soldier. Shot up the synagogue in Wisconsin. We heard from Rob yesterday. So thankful to be out of there. They said that Mr. Miller, among many other whites, telegraphed their actions. I intend to kill such and such, blow up such and such, whatever it is, whatever the terrorist act is, that they announced this. Nothing was done about it. Even in some cases, they said, I believe it was Frazier Glenn Miller that he stole from a military installation, weaponry and such, and nothing was done about it. They tried to report it, and not a priority. Now, contrast that system of racism, white supremacy, the response to, I don't know, it was Nigger Friday, right? Nigger Friday, so you're supposed to go to the store and put everybody in the headlock, choke them out so that you can get a new gold plunger. Jonathan Crawford III, toy gun at Walmart. What was the response there? That's not a good one. That's not stupid. That's why I said those metaphors. Let's do a better one. Khalif Browder. That's a good one. So we got Frazier Glenn Miller has clear racist conduct stolen from a military information. Military installation. That's not a priority. We'll get to that later. Khalif Browder, 17-year-old. We think he may have stolen a backpack. That's the one we want to focus on. Wait a minute, but we got a white man who... This nigga stole a backpack. That's the one we want to focus on. That sort of pattern is pretty consistent in the system of white supremacy. That white, because you see the same thing. Remember with Jeffrey Dahmer, way before he had chomped and killed all those people, mostly non-white people in Wisconsin, he got stopped, and I believe he was on parole. We did our homework on that one. I believe he had already had a criminal record, recidivist they call it. He got stopped by enforcement officers with a body in the car, and it wasn't, oh, wait a minute, we got a hoodlum here. You got a record. Let me go through your glove compartment. Let me run through the hood. That's what they do, right? Check all that. Pull you out of the car. We might unscrew the seats and everything. Look through here and make sure. Look kind of mischievous. You got those little beady eyes, Dahmer. That's not what they did. Let him roll right on. Didn't stop him. Body in the car. If they had stopped him, then we had that so many times with Dahmer. There was so many opportunities. He's a white man. He's good. We got 17-year-old niggas stealing backpacks. We don't have time to focus on one white man who's chomping black teenagers and eating them, sometimes in reverse order. And you heard the same pattern even within the audio tonight. They ran, and I did that on purpose, so you heard that one first. Then they went to the schools, and they talked about the white children. President Obama, you're wrong, victim. But they talked about the white children at the schools. They had the white teachers. We're overrun. What to do? Do you have a manual? The young Dylan Roofs, the young, I don't know what the female of that would be, the young Diana Roofs. They're coming in. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to say. And you heard the exact same pattern. That white woman, she said, uh-oh, I see this young white fella. He's got this patch on his jacket. I know what that's all about. That's white supremacy racism. I go to report it to the officials. Hey, wait a minute. You all just saw Dylan Roof. You just saw the incident last week in Georgia. This young fella, he's got a patch on. I don't know. You sure you don't have any niggas stealing backpacks? Wait a minute. He's got this patch on. She said they seemed confused. Isn't the word we used? Are you serious? You have a white educator who comes to tell you this young fella here has got terrorist paraphernalia. Eh? White, what is it? You say it's white now? She says she went to the dean. She didn't say she went to the janitor. She didn't say she went to the remedial English teacher. She said she went to the dean, and the response, he seemed confused. Didn't seem like it was a priority. We need to stop everything. And then finally they go search the locker, and what do they say? Uh-oh, he's got all kinds of flyers, racist paraphernalia, even got drawings of lynched niggers. Now again, you got Kalief Browder. Never even got charged, unless, you know, my memory, they tell me my memory is bad. Kalief Browder never even got charged. That's serious. We can't, that's, the nation is about to fall apart if we start to allow niggers to run wild with backpacks. You got white children, got their locker full of terrorist paraphernalia, they are ready to roll. We'll get to that later. Frazier Glenn Miller has robbed the military. We'll get to that later. Kalief Browder, that is maximum time and energy. You think we're going to let these niggers get around here and steal a book bag? Next, they'll be stealing white women connected to book bags. We know all about the Kalief Browders. Next on the list, they had a black female on the program. Loretta Ross, that's her name, Loretta Ross, victim of racism. So they had her on to talk about, she's doing the same thing, working with these young white people. They said she teaches a class on white supremacy to white students. Now that was almost worthy of a rewind. Who is most confused about white supremacy racism? And those are the dynamics you have. A black person here to teach. And these aren't even white children. These are basically white adults. Younger, but I mean, it's not like we're talking about 12-year-olds. She was at a college. Teaching them about racism. They are already experts. They already know. If she thinks she learned something from this white supremacist just hearing about what these little 19 and 20-year-olds, what they know and what they've heard from their parents, they got the PhDs in white supremacy racism easily. But even within that, in the segment, Miss Ross, victim of racism again, VGQ, hate is not, they said, white guilt. She says, that's what I enjoy. That's what excites me. Being able to teach these young white students, these young white people, to teach them to subvert, work against allegedly white supremacy without being stuck in white guilt. I have no idea what that is, that entire concept to suggest that white people feel bad about mistreating black people. You would not have the proliferation of racist jokes if white people, males, females, children, felt bad about practicing racism. Dylann Roof has not expressed any remorse about racism. He said he's an expert. He didn't say he felt guilty or remorseful. The young white girl that they haven't identified down in Georgia, I haven't heard any comments of, I feel really bad about this, or I feel really bad about being a white person, if you want to generalize it. None of that. I think all of that is a lie. I think the only thing is at times white people might feel some type of way about being caught. If it seems like there might be some trouble, but other than that, like, absolutely not. Like, that's what they're supposed to do. They enjoy and brag about mistreating black people all the time. They said that young fella had pictures in his locker of a black person being lynched. Probably President Obama. Pick the black person. Let's see. Oh, they said, I thought it was so important. They said, we got racial focal pointing. Caller in Florida made up that term when they try to make it seem as though the racists are just the Nazis. The racists are the ultra-white right-wingers. The racists are the conservatives. The racists are the white men. It'll, whatever it is to narrow the group so that we don't think, wait a minute, everybody classified as white should be suspected of being a race soldier. You're no different than Dylann Roof. You're no different than that white teenager, white female teenager, who was going to hack up those black people at the church in Georgia last week. You're no different. That's a very different way of talking about white supremacy racism. And Ms. Ross in the segment, victim. They said that we want you to go after the Nazis, not the allies, presumably other white people who you disagree with how they are dealing with the Nazis and that sort of thing. That is exactly, and I mean verbatim. I can go and pull the episode because it was election. It was 2016. I was getting ready to predict accurately that President Trump was going to win. That is exactly what Bill Maher said when non-white people, victims of racism, were pointing out, hey, I don't really want to vote for Hillary Clinton because I think she's a racist. And he said, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. What are you doing? The racist is Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton is your ally. And he was calling out black people exclusively. This was not a black and brown thing. This was black people. I think I played the clip on the program. And it was, wait a minute. She's an ally. What are you doing? You're messing up. You should have enough sense and not be so stupid. I mean, he got real indignant about it. You shouldn't be so stupid to be wasting all this time calling out your allies like Hillary Clinton and her husband. I mean, maybe she said something bad and she's made missteps, but she's clearly against, you know, the evil ones and the real racists, the Donald Trumps. And get out of here. All of that is nonsense. All of that is leading you towards authentic confusion about what it means to be classified as white. Do not ever be confused to think the only racist, the nonsense that they said about the dean, thinking that you got to be a racist, you got to have a swastika or something like that. Classified as white, that is all you should need for suspicion to skyrocket. That's all you need. Not a bald head, not a swastika, not a tattoo of 88, not any other paraphernalia. Are you classified as white? That is enough. Next. She had a lot of interesting metaphors in there, group pylons. Oh, man. I got to go back to the pregnancy segment. I do think the system of white supremacy does an excellent job. I thought it was so important when she said that I'll end up having mental health problems or feeling as though I need help, but I'm embarrassed to ask for assistance. I think the system of white supremacy does a spectacular job of discouraging us to request constructive help, like making us feel as though there's something wrong with us, that there's something bad about us asking for help. When whites, they do more asking for help when they don't even need it. They do this on a constant basis, asking for assistance that's totally not even needed, whether it's financial or anything else, just to ask. And frequently we'll get it. Whereas non-white people just asking for something that is constructive. I am a mom. I just could use a little bit of help. Just maybe if you could just, you know, look after my child safely for a little while, just so that I could get 30 minutes to just do some breathing exercises. That would help me immensely. Just, you know, a little bit, and they'll make you feel like, oh my, you're so lazy. And I'm not even a parent, and I know it happens to me, and I've heard it from so many people. I've heard it with compensatory investment requests where people said that they do not feel comfortable, or they feel embarrassed or some type of way about asking someone for assistance. In my view, if there was a system of justice, there would never be a reason to hesitate for making a request for something constructive. I'm not saying all of us, but I think a lot of black people, because I think sometimes white, but they'll call you names for asking for help for something constructive. We've played a report. It was a black mom. She had her child with her. He had a bloody nose. They went to the fire department, not a crack house. The fire department to get ice, not Jordans, not a cell phone, ice. And they could not get it. The fire department practiced racism. We played the clip on the compensatory call-in. So I can totally grasp victims of white supremacy might be a little hesitant to ask for help from anybody, white people or non-white people. You can't even get ice sometimes. You can't even get water sometimes. Make an effort to ask for things that are constructive. That is super important anybody, if you're feeling that, like, wait a minute, am I feeling hesitant? They might say, no, I'm not saying that you're going to get it, but at least ask. Ask for things that are constructive. I think that should be done. And I think even Mr. Fuller said that that should be a part of the counter-racist process, to ask for things, if it's help, whatever else, request things that are constructive. Certainly assistance if and when you need it. Let's see. I'll get in one more. Last one I'll get in. Right in with the same thing with the report on postpartum depression. A lot of times when I hear that, when they talk about mental illness, and I think in that report they said that black people don't know postpartum depression. I do. That was a part of our prenatal training. Not that I hadn't heard the term before, but I mean, we had to talk about that quite a bit in prenatal teacher training, yoga teacher training. But I will hear that black people don't talk about mental health, or black people don't encourage talking about mental health. It'll be some kind of way of blaming black people, that we don't encourage going to talk to a therapist or something like that. I hear this with black males and black females. I don't hear as frequently, wait a minute, you do have the book Protest Psychosis. Wait a minute, you do have a history of black people. They'll just make up any sort of term. What is it? We got a caller. What's her name? I think that might be the reason for the handle. Draptomania. What do you say? This nigga doesn't want to be lashed. You're trying to run. Oh, that's a medical condition. The whole premise of the book Protest Psychosis is they did the same thing in the 1960s. Oh, these niggas are running around saying that they don't like being mistreated, and they're going to protest and march. Oh, they must be crazy. They're schizophrenic. We'll just put some terms on them and lock them up. If you're not going to prison, we'll put you in a medical institution and drug you up, do some experiments on you, different way, medical apartheid. But they have done this long record of this, so that might be another means to make you a little bit hesitant if you're a black mom. And I love the point where she said, hey, wait a minute. Or she didn't say we're the system of white supremacy, but that's what it is. I'm a little hesitant about coming out to talk to white people about anything. Maybe I don't want to come out and tell you that I'm, you know, feeling a little depressed, because it's very easy in a system of racism for white people to take children from black people. Super easy. Tons of evidence of that. Dorothy Roberts' book, Shattered Bonds. She was a guest on the program many times. We talked about that book specifically in 2010. That's the whole premise of the book. It is super easy for them to steal. Has been for the duration of racism, white supremacy, and continues to be so. Much less if I'm coming in and saying I think I've got, you know, some mental health issues or whatever with my child, or might need assistance. That might be grounds. And sometimes that is grounds. Oh, maybe this child would be better off. We have a lovely transgender family, and they're just looking forward to having an addition to their child. Maybe they can take care, better care of this child than you right now while you get your mental health problems together. Pause there. Number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. It's not like they make benefits readily accessible so that all of the black people in the known universe have spectacular healthcare coverage. Thank you, Obamacare, where we can go and see a therapist of our choice anytime. And we have readily available access to black mental health care providers, where we can talk about racism, white supremacy, in addition to our other problems that are vexing and causing us anxiety. Since this is the compensatory call-in, if we could not use metaphors, that would be spectacular. Racists will frequently invoke a lot. There were a number of them in the call-in. They said group pile-ons. I don't even know what that is. If we could not use metaphors to articulate our views, that would be awesome. If we could speak as directly as possible to what we would like to say, racists will frequently take two separate entities and insist that they are identical, one and the same, and often they are not. That is a part of the master deception. Victims, myself included, often We have not come to a conclusion on a specific subject, which is fine. But what that means is that sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views. And so instead, we'll substitute with an analogy, metaphor of some sort. Often that just produces more confusion. If we could be direct, explicit with what it is we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about metaphors. Thank you kindly. If we could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, views, just make sure everyone gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could make an effort to get to a quiet spot, and please use your mute button. That way we don't have to compete with unnecessary audio disruptions. It just helps preserve the quality of the broadcast. If you know you want to talk, you can unmute your line once you're kind of in a quiet space. Share your thoughts and then mute again. Then if you have another thought, question that you want to add, you can unmute and share again. Much obliged for your cooperation. Star 6, oh, I guess I'll share it later. We should have a white woman on the program this week. I think I announced it yesterday, but I'll get that in as we roll. Star 6-1 for the folks who would like to chime in. First few folks who dialed with hand up, line should be open. Again, I will say again, just because tomorrow we will be here, that's more immediate. It is 30 minutes late. We normally would be on 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That's our normal start time. It'll be 8:30 Eastern, 5:30 Pacific tomorrow afternoon for Azure Savage so that I can safely get back after teaching a little yoga. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, lines should be open. Again, if you have any Thanksgiving counter-racist tales you would like to share, we can get those in as we proceed as well. Feel free, folks who dialed in, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I didn't expect to be called upon this early, but nevertheless, you on your report you mentioned about weaponry, and the I think it may have something to do with the access thereof. What I do watch television, I watch a lot of things on YouTube because you can select on what you want to see. And there, YouTube is filled with reports on white people and weapons. I mean, there is not a conceivable weapon that you do not see some white person bragging about, envying and showing how to operate it. The only thing that I haven't seen yet is an atomic bomb that they haven't had in their hands. I've seen tanks, machine guns, landmines, explosives of all types. And these people are not even connected with the quote-unquote professional international enforcement called the U.S. Army or Marines, anything. Walking through the woods in full in uniform, that they are smart enough not to have U.S. Army or something like that on the uniform. And I'm saying, well, what are you training for? What are you training for? What are you getting prepared? What are you preparing people for? That sort of thing. These reports can last 20 minutes, 30 minutes, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, white people have access to firearms and they love them. They love them, I would say, like they love white children. That may be a metaphor, but anyway, sorry about that. But also, another story. You said something about speaking on Thanksgiving. Didn't participate as usual. I am one of five siblings. There are two of us who reside within driving distance. She has opted to start her process on becoming a vegan, and that certainly is not compatible to that day, two days ago, to being a vegan. And I think she is going beyond the idea of something white people call Thanksgiving. Anyway, but regardless of that, my thoughts is even those non-white black families who participate in it, what do they talk about during that period of time when all of these people, because I've seen them, I've seen where cars are around people's homes, what are they actually talking about during that period of time? I mean, is there any talk on racism, white supremacy at all? Or some other healthy things such as, like I heard Mr. Fuller said, getting nutrition proficiency, you know, that sort of thing. What are non-white people talking about during that period of time when they are in under one roof together? Those who do practice that, and just a thought of mine, and I'll finish on what I'm saying and listen to someone else. Thank you.
Exchanging views, that is a part of how we invest our time and energy, according to Mr. Fuller, in terms of correct use of time and energy. And yeah, what are we talking about? I think that is an important one. It should be things that are substantially more important to discuss than what goodies we hope to get for White Jesus's birthday, or what new movies are coming out, or who's going to win the big football game, or whatever else. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we've not heard from you and you have a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy. Yes, ma'am.
Greetings to us and greetings to all the callers on the line. I wanted to speak on the Jim Jones situation. There's I haven't read the book, but I heard the hour-long interview with the author. It's called Slavery of Faith by Leslie Wagner. And she said that that they didn't see him as white because he said he was Native American and he had dark hair and things like that, so he could have been. So it seemed plausible to them. He looked Mexican to me. And she said that they feared him because he made it to where if they tried to get away or anything like that, he beat them. He would shock children, like electric shock, and he would have threats and things like that to bar them from leaving. He shot people. He killed people on the railroad track who tried escaping. He locked people up in rooms and injected them with things. He tortured them, and he was the head of the housing commission, and he had powerful positions with connections to more powerful whites. And his, so they had a lot of, you know, fear, and his leadership were white females, which were his mistresses. And also he forced them to drink the poison. And Jonestown also, it was mostly elderly people, poor people, and children. And many of the children, they were living with family from the foster care system. And the Jonestown place or whatever, it had free health care, residential care homes for them, free legal services, food for the hungry, concession setups for the poor to buy and sell. They had a needs committee. So they, you know, just, you know, relied on, like, they these were people who just, they really needed help. and that it wasn't a church. There wasn't any Bible study. There was only choir rehearsal, and that it just had a religious name for tax purposes. And he also led them to believe that they were like socialist revolutionaries, where they were writing letters all night to Congress and others to get people out of prison. And that, you know, Guyana was to be a community to make a difference, and that the members, you know, they were supposed to be family. And he also separated the families as well, which made them even more reliant on him and the staff there and things of that nature, and made them more, I guess, vulnerable to harm. And I think that's all I will share for right now. Oh, I wanted to say I'll just say one more thing that has nothing to do with this at all. Somebody made a statement about that called black people minions. Black people are not minions, and that's name calling, and it's inaccurate. They're victims. And somebody mentioned that they wanted advice on where to buy books and things of that nature. And this was already mentioned, but I just wanted to, I guess, reinforce it. Buy used books, because you can get them at, you know, a great discount. And that's all I have for now. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. The procedure is generally, I still say it's best to ask the person when they use a term to ask them, well, what do you mean when you say minion? That is best. But for what it's worth, I looked up the term just to get a few extra tidbits. And minion, noun, a follower or underling of a powerful person, especially a servile or unimportant one. And I thought that was important because, yeah, if that's the definition, then that's not even an accurate use of the term at all. Either aspect, even if that last portion wasn't on it, that wouldn't be accurate either, because we are not followers. We are subject to. That is substantially different. Was there, did we miss? Oh, yes, ma'am. Were you going to add?
I was just going to quickly say, I didn't have to ask the person what they meant, because they explained it when they made the statement, and that's why I said what I said. I didn't, because I didn't want to run over the 5 minutes, I didn't go through, you know, what they said and why I responded the way that I did. But the response that I did give, it was based on the, I guess, explanation that they gave for why they were calling these victims minions.
Much obliged. Appreciate the respect in the 5 minutes. Everybody can get their time in. I just looked up the definition for me. I was just curious to see what it had to say. And I think that was recently in the archives, so people can go back and hear the person that dialed in and used that term and the whole context for how they shared it. No name calling. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments, proceed. Actually, hang on 1 second. I do want to make sure there was an article I wanted to share. I think several listeners shared this with me. So I played the report, or at least I included it when I shared the episode when I was promoting. There was a brawl at a high school football game, another reason they should get rid of it, in Michigan, between Denby High School, D-E-N-B-Y, and Almont, A-L-M-O-N-T, High School. Again, this is in Michigan. And so it seems racism, white supremacy was a part of the brawl. Lots of accusations that white parents were yelling racist slurs, comments, profanities from the stands at black children and black spectators, things. I think it got so bad that the game was actually stopped. So there was a report written in Deadline Detroit, November 25th, that's the beginning of the week, titled Suburban Football Jeering Makes Detroit High School Counselor Ashamed to Be a White Man. And as a follow-up to coverage of the offensive behavior at a high school football game in Commerce Township, it doesn't say racist, just says offensive. So this is written by Bob Berg. Today I witnessed something that made me sick. Racism and bigotry still run rampant in this country. It was the first time in my life that I have been ashamed to be a white man. Now that might be worthy of a pause right there, because this fellow looks like he's over 55, which means he would have been alive during the King. I mean, you would have had a lot of opportunities to be ashamed to be a white man. Anyway. First of all, these Detroit Denby football players are just wonderful. The past 9 months, I have been lucky enough to have been able to work, teach, and train with these great young men. Today, November 23rd, they were railroaded. I won't make excuses, but these numbers don't lie. 32 total penalties for 217 yards, one touchdown taken away because of a phantom call. That is a metaphor. I think he means a penalty. 8 first downs taken away from penalties. But this isn't about the loss. When leaving the field, our kids were spit on, pelted with garbage, and one young man was punched in the face by an Almont parent. That's what I thought. His parents said that. And I've heard this is the only thing that stood out about this is that it got reported a lot, and then this white man wrote this report. But I mean, this is about once a week that one of these gets a lot of attention, and I'm sure it happens more than that where it doesn't make the news of what happened. But this is very, very common. I even stopped to look at James Lowen's sundown towns to see if this town, this part of Michigan, because that state is a lot in sundown towns, mentioned about Klan activity and terrorizing black people. After we were able to get our kids in a safe area, they locked us all in a caged area in the corner of the field when we just wanted to get the kids safely on our bus. Almont parents were spitting on our kids, throwing things, and threatening our kids like animals. No one protected our kids. I don't generally call black children kids. Those are goats. Our great principal, Tanisha Manningham, I think that is, was spit on, and we were pushed and verbally abused by two of the officers. We had mace canisters aimed at all of us. Our student manager was called a monkey. The sad thing is all of our coaches and kids respect law enforcement and authority. They are so respectful. I have never been so proud as I am to be a part of a great school like Denby. Great coach, great head coach, great staff, great alumni, great teachers and administrators, and most of all, greatest kids anywhere. I promise the accountability of the attacks will be addressed. The record will be set straight. I promise you these kids are resilient. Well, the article again is entitled "Ashamed to Be a White Man," written by Bob Berg. Might see if we can find him if he wants to chat on the cows. This would be another, at least for me, I don't have children, but if I did, I would not have them participate in high school athletics. Definitely no football, no need for brain damage, no need to be spit on and pelted with racism. Other folks, if you have comments, and, oops, if we have missed
Hello.
You. Irie, yes, ma'am.
Salutations, everybody. Hello, Gus. Nice to hear your show on the line again. it's ironic that I was at a basketball game for my younger sibling. And it was hosted in a city that I was unsure if it was a sundown town, but I think it is, even though it's unofficially a sundown town in my mind. And the impression I got was that white people host and go to high school football, basketball games. This one in particular was basketball, and they do so with the hope that there will be an incident. The gym was segregated with a few white people sitting among non-white people if they happen to have children on the same team. But other than that, it was very stratified. Well, no, wait, that's a metaphor. There was visible separation. And then the refs also made sure they didn't call fouls when they were supposed to. If there was a non-white team playing a white team or a non-white team that was from out of town. even though everyone could see and, you know, the coaches contested. But what I wanted to call and say, I didn't get a chance to hear the headlines you broadcasted, but yesterday I wanted to say, please pardon that analogy I made. I guess I was trying to convey one way or another, even if you work in a particular function that is related to a holiday, you still shouldn't have to participate in the holiday. But then I thought about it later. I was like, that may have been a little silly. So everyone that was listening to that and will listen, please pardon that. But, you know, that's just how aggravated I was trying to find a way to put it. And the other thing I wanted to say is in the search for, you know, healthy lifestyles, I think this is a good thing to do, to look into. I have been going to a popular tanning place and laying in the infrared tanning bed for 20 minutes at a time. It costs about $30 a month, and I go 3 times a week. And I do this because my research said that infrared light and heat penetrates down to the bones. It helps release, it helps the body make collagen, which is good for your joints. And then when your joints are basically stabilized, it'll go to your skin. It also helps you eliminate, inflammation, and can help with other maladies like fighting diseases, so forth and so on. You can buy infrared light systems at home, but right now, because I don't have my own home and everything right now, I'm just going to be, you know, going there. And then when I have my own permanent setup, I'll probably invest in something like that for the home. But I do see results. I do feel better when I get out of it. I sweat a lot in the machine, but when I get out, I do feel better. I notice a difference in my joints because they're pretty bad from my service in the military, but not so much anymore. And I am seeing some reduction in fine lines on my face, which I was skeptical that would happen, but it's happening. And I wanted to give that recommendation to people who are trying to improve their health, you know, and I'm doing this in conjunction with a vegan lifestyle. So that's it. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great night. And thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Irie. That is interesting. I have not been cool enough to try out the infrared tanning beds. They have infrared heating at the yoga studio, but that is, I'm sure, not quite the same benefits, or maybe, I don't know if it's similar or not, but infrared tanning, wow. If you're feeling better and you said your skin is doing better and your joints are feeling better, then hey, keep it up. With the reducing inflammation, I will remind folks, my prenatal yoga instructor, when I was speaking with her about yoga to reduce inflammation, which she was saying it can, provided that you are practicing on a regular basis, like, you know, 5 times a week or something close to daily. But she said, hey, what you eat has a lot to do with inflammation. You can eat foods that will tend towards being inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. I think ginger is one on the list, but being mindful about what you eat can be very helpful in reducing inflammation. And I think Dr. Ruby Lathan talked about that. She's been on several times, but I think the first 2 times she was on, I think she talked about that in some detail. Let's see. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. This is yes, sir, Thomas.
Sorry,
just gonna say really quick for folks to make sure, no waiting, until the last 5 minutes. I know that is our favorite trick, and you might be enjoying an extra slice of pie, turkey leg, giblets, country ham biscuits, whatever it is. Whatever you're going to enjoy, do that, but please do not make that an excuse to wait until the last minute and then decide now is the time I want to call in to share my last 10 points. Thank you kindly. Thomas in New York, proceed.
Hey, Gus, man, I want you to finish this statement for me. You uppity blank. What would you think?
You said you always, you uppity blank, just fill it in, you uppity blank. Uh-oh. Did we lose him? Are you still with us, Thomas in New York?
You uppity blink.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought. All right. If I was, am I filling it in for just a random person who said this? Am I saying it, or do I get anything?
No, I just wanted to know what your general consensus as a black man, what would you think would be the next word if you heard that statement?
Oh, boy. I would. If I had to guess, I would think it's probably going to be you uppity nigger. That just seemed reflexive.
That's what I thought too. And I posed this question to a bunch of people where they all said Negro. I said, you uppity Negro. I've never heard it that way. It's always been you uppity nigger, but either way, I brought it up. Because our good friends across the pond, they do it a little bit different. So UK TV network bans uppity as a racist word. So you can't use uppity on your network anymore after one of the viewers complained over their criticism of talking about Meghan Markle, because she's always concerned. They don't even call her by her name. They just say uppity, the uppity princess. So I think that the Negro princess, so pretty... also from across the pond, Boris Johnson calls gay men tank top bum boys, and black people pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. I said, man, so, I mean, how many black people they got with watermelons in the UK? I mean, that's a straight up U.S. terminology, but, you know, it just goes all around the world, and everyone knows what it means, just the system. Boston Dynamics dog on the Massachusetts State Police. I saw your report. Also, look into this article on Nightscope. Nightscope is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T. Scope, S-C-O-P-E. And I've actually seen these. They had a showroom of them in Manhattan, and it wasn't too far from where I was working at the time, and I could see them just rolling around like R2-D2. And they even have one that looks like a car now that goes on the streets. But from the article, Nightscope's thermal imaging cameras can identify what's under everyone's clothes. Nightscopes can label someone a person of interest with terms like causes trouble or sketchy dude. Thesaurus.com describes causes trouble as challenging the status quo to disagree or protest. The article also indicates that Nightscope has the access to things like domestic violence records, driver's license suspensions, custody disputes, and, of course, hostile terminations. Because one of the major places they were pushing these robots is in the offices to replace the security in the office buildings. And, in fact, they just got a bid with the United States government. They will be in the Pentagon. They will be in the... in the major offices on the Capitol, and including all the Army bases, will have these things doing the patrolling pretty soon. Nightscope's robocops can discreetly scan wireless devices and match a person's face to their cell phone. This capability allows the robot to discreetly track individuals in their proximity, regardless of whether they can identify their faces. Just having your cell phone by it, it's going to pick up that's your cell phone by your UP, your IP address. The presentation details how a person's cell phone can be matched to their identity. It can track every time the person comes into a proximity of a Nightscope robot, over a course of several days. So These things are highly intelligent. These are going to be, if these things won't be policing us, the capabilities these things have will be given to the police that we have. And also, you have this thing called City IQ, which are streetlights. They got over 4,500 of these in Detroit, in San Diego, and they expect to have more than twice that amount in Detroit very soon, 2020. They check emergency responses, traffic light control, location alerts, vibration detection, seismic detection, audio recording, gunshot detection. If you shoot a gunshot, it's going to track it right to this place where that initial sound was made. So it's no way to get away from that. Wi-Fi provisions, local hotspot connection, environmental inspection, weather monitoring, video recording, parking assistance, and these will be in control of any protest or anything. They do crowd and traffic monitoring. And these are just through the streetlights. So this is where we're heading in the new system of white supremacy as it gets more enhanced and more refined. I mute my line, Gus.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I did make an effort to track down the audio where you were saying a few weeks back, look out for the robotic dogs. It's just like Black Mirror. They're coming. I did make an effort to find it, but I failed. I had to go with a different clip to lead in, but I did remember you were just talking about that, and then it was right there in the BBC News segment this week where they are here, and I will be coming to. I was thinking that's the new school resource officer. Like, it won't be Officer Slam, it'll be Spot. They can just put him in the school, and righto. That was a part of the Ferguson report, that they had the dogs were chewing up the Black students anyway, so just put Spot there, and, you know, no problem. He can call in backup if need be, or put some teeth on Black Mirror, put some teeth on him, put a gun on him, and there you go. No problem. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we missed you totally and you have questions, comments you want to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, M. Han DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. Sorry, I'm transitioning from one space to another. But yes, so I wanted to say a few things quickly. One thing I wanted to say was a month ago or so, I was talking about a shooting that happened.
Your audio went really low for a sec. We can barely hear you. Yeah, it dropped really low. Okay, we can hear you now. I can hear you now. I think we can hear you now. We can hear you now. Yes.
Okay.
Just make sure you start over, because I missed everything. It was almost like we couldn't hear you at all. So just go ahead and start over.
Oh yes, sir. So I was. Saying,
oh, and it disappeared. It did it again. That's so crazy. As soon as you started it, it vanished. Or it didn't vanish, just it went really low. I don't know if it's a reception issue or if you're on a headset or something, but it your volume will be fine, and then it'll get really, really quiet.
If it keeps doing that, I'll just try again later. But my phone's been working pretty okay, for me.
This time. Is my volume okay right now?
It just popped back in. You're okay now. Yes, sir.
All right, let's check it out.
Oh, and it dropped. That's crazy. That's crazy.
Can I just call back and try again?
Oh, sure. I'll look out for you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. To be expected, system of white supremacy. Even 2020 now, keep all that, they have Spot now, should be slightly better. But he's in a vehicle, so I guess we'll give some latitude there. It's supposed to be you're moving around. The signal might not be quite as reliable if you're depending on where you are traveling. In the meantime, other folks, if you have comments, questions, make sure I get it. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio, Invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, Cash App does work, should be linked as well. cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested a decade plus of making sure we are broadcasting. I hope we have been worthy of your time and energy. If you're not into all of that, you can drop us an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. You can also nab items from my wish list at Amazon.com. Coon Monday is coming, also known as Cyber Monday. If you are getting in on the consumption frenzy, feel free to nab an item or three from Gus T's wish list. It is at Gus T Renegade at Amazon. It is linked at my blog. Much obliged to all the investors who have purchased items over the past decade plus. I hope the cows has provided accurate information about white supremacy, racism, and suggestions, things that we can do to go about solving this problem immediately. Let's see. I think Imhan DC is back with us. We will try again. Let's see if your audio is working. You want to give us a sound check, sir? Maybe not. Maybe we were fooled. Not hearing you. If you are with us, Imhan DC, not hearing anything at all, it seems. We'll see if he might be waiting to get to a spot where he can speak. If you want to unmute or what have you, feel free. Your line should be open. You can chime in and let us know. In the meantime, other folks, if you have questions, comments you would like to share, feel free.
Even if you spoke already, Gus?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. My apologies about the definition. I didn't understand you. I thought that you were saying typically you look up the definition because I was addressing the Minion statement. I thought you were referring to me addressing the Minion statement without, I guess, looking up the definition, but you were actually referring to the fact that you were going to look it up. And so I'm sorry I misunderstood you. And, you know, thank you for the support, even looking it up and, you know, supporting me in that. And I wanted to quickly say, VGQ for everyone who disagrees, but in my view, Booker, what's his name? Is his name Trevor Booker, Gus?
There is a Trevor Booker, yes. Who are you talking about, or which report are you talking about?
The man who who's running for political office. Cory Booker, that's right. In my view, he's not a black person. Black people don't have blue eyes, and I think he did some type of, I don't know if it was a DNA thing or something like that, but whatever it was, it turned out he was like 47% white. Black people are not that, and it's kind of like, what's his name? Muhammad Ali, he has a grandson who is white. So just because you have, you know, somebody black, I guess, in your family or whatever it might be, that don't make you black, and I just don't consider him to be, a black person. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say is that, you know, hope everyone has as good a weekend as they can have under white supremacy. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Senator, Honorable Senator Cory Booker. Going to be a challenging campaign to unseat Donald Trump. But again, my apologies. I said before that he had a white parent, and that is not accurate. Make sure I get that in on the record. But yes, VGQ to Cory Booker. Hopefully we did not impugn his chances to do well by giving out inaccurate information here. Let's see. Other folks, again, I believe Imhan DC should be with us if you want to try again to see if your audio was working while we're waiting there. Other folks?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Your audio sounds good so far.
Cool, cool. Okay. Yes, sir. So I spoke maybe a month ago or so about some black men who were riding around in a car and shooting. I don't know what exactly they were shooting at, but they were shooting while driving down two blocks, and they passed my house while doing this shooting. Looked out the blinds, saw the person, saw the car, you know. But I went and I asked the neighbor, you know, did you see the car? Which, you know, which direction did this car go? Did you ask him about the shooting? That had cussed me. They started, well, one of them started cussing, and the other, like, it was a weird exchange, except I thought everything was fine. Like, it seemed like we were both looking, you know, like we were both concerned. He was riding a bicycle, you know, looking for people, I guess, or I don't know. And then when I was telling him, hey, did you just experience what happened? You know, what do you think? Do you know who did it? Which way did the car go? Who was, or, you know, what do you know? And we were, you know, and he asked me, you know, similar questions. And then once I finally explained to him, well, you know, I seen the vehicle and it went past my house. They didn't shoot at the house, but at the same time, it went past my house. Now they were shooting down two blocks, so it wasn't just, you know, towards my house. But when I said that, he said that it was my beef now. Speaking to his female companion, well, say that all to say. So this is a new block for me, right? So since I've come back from Ghana, I've moved over here, you know, help with my mom since she moved here to this block. My original block, my neighbors do not act like that. They don't cuss me out when I have serious questions. And I've not come across a situation where we've had, where there's been a problem on the block and we discuss it and somebody say, oh, that's your beef, or, you know, or that's your problem. I haven't had that on the block that I really live on. You know, this is just a temporary block or whatever. That to say, it's important to speak to your neighbors. And over here, I haven't spoken to all my neighbors. I speak to my neighbors. But then the ones that I had an issue with are the ones I haven't had any interaction with. But it's just two males. But my point is I didn't have any interaction with them. On the first block, I actually, you know, that I call my residence, where I, you know, the family owns the house. A lot of the people on that block, a lot of the people own their houses, and so they're going to be there for a long time, and. I made it a point to go and meet all the neighbors, and we speak all the time. Sometimes we, you know, I go to their house and drink coffee or, you know, there's been occasions where I would, take a drink of, an alcoholic beverage, which is not, something I'm promoting at all, but, you know, like we would sit down and we talk. I went and speak to the men my age, black people on my block. Speak to the men my age. Hey, I got a gun. You got a gun. This is the type of gun I have. You have that type of gun. That's pretty cool. I want you to know that on this block that I'm living on, I don't expect there to be any killings on my block. And if you have any problems, I want you to know that you can at least come to me or come to this house for help. And if we have problems, I would hope we could do the same to, you know, and I did this with a lot of the black men, like most of them. And I talk about racism to that the people on that block. I don't think I would have had the same problems on that block as on this block. If somebody came down shooting down two blocks and I started asking questions, I don't think I would have had the same problems. That may have been long-winded. The other thing I wanted to mention was, in general, just having a gun as a black man. I think that it's mandatory. Without having the ability to enforce anything myself, I say that it's mandatory. That black men, you have to have a Glock 19, and if you don't, I consider you being neglectful. I consider that a gross negligence, if you do not own a Glock 19 or a similar handgun. And the other thing I would say is just in general, America belongs to the black Americans. Those people who are on the reservations look like white Chinese people. Those are not the Native Americans. I've gone to those reservations, to some of the reservations. I've seen the people. Those aren't the Native Americans. Those aren't the original people. The original people were much darker, more like black people, or were black people. And I say, this is our land and not the land of the Chinese, not the land of the white people, the ice albino, not the land of the Arab. This is our land and only our land. And white people are not supposed to be here, nor are any of the other people who are here that have not come with our invitation. We haven't given anybody our invitation. So no one's supposed to be here except black Americans, and everybody needs to leave. And we're going to have to, in order to solve white supremacy, we're going to have to be away from white people. We're not going to be able to make them a nicer people and stay beside them and then end white supremacy in that fashion. They cannot be here. Not in America. They can't be here. That's what I say. Perhaps they can figure something to control us from some, you know, the other place that they are that's not here in America. But I say that they have to leave here. So thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. I think if they get that spot, if they get it refined, that they might be able to exit and be elsewhere, and much less leave the so-called country. They might be able to leave the so-called planet and keep everything operating, make sure that Spot doesn't have any breakdowns. They can get new upgrades for his applications. With the first portion and making sure that you talk to people who reside in the same area that you do, I didn't say community, reside in the same area that you do. That's important, just so that you know those folks, can help minimize conflicts, or if there is a problem, then you all have some rapport where you can maybe work together constructively to solve the problem. Whereas that didn't seem like it was happening, where you're going to help out your mom and you don't really know they're not really your neighbors, right? Because you don't really live there. So, you know, they're strangers. And yeah, I guess it not being constructive in what was happening. All of that, in my view, is the system of white supremacy. Just having that. I mean, that, and again, that's why this is not a community. You got people that are riding up and down the street shooting guns, and then they'll come back. It'll be easy in an environment like that to go to what Thomas said. Oh, yeah, we got to have the IQ street lights. Oh, yeah, we got random Negro violence that we got to curtail and send in proper authorities, get Spot out there to go to the crime scene. Like, oh, yeah, we got to get these lights like yesterday. But that is not a community. And then you try to go out and, hey, we had a really dangerous situation just happened. They didn't shoot at the house, but I mean, they could have. And either way, I don't want that happening in an environment where I live. And it's, you know, hey, whatever, you know, that's your problem now. It's like, whoa, what? Not a community. That is the system of white supremacy, to just conflict, danger. That's why I say that at the end of all the programs, that's what's intended for areas where black people live. And I think what you were saying, that is working towards trying to get a code to try to remedy that, where these folks are not strangers. We have some rapport and a constructive rapport where we're trying to be safe, look out for each other as best we can under limited circumstances, but not communities. Star 6-1, if you have comments or questions. Other folks, if you have suggestions, commentary you'd like to add, we have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast. Again, make sure, no waiting until the very last moment, if you think you have a question, comment you would like to add to the broadcast.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, this is caller from the 712. Hey, I keep getting disconnected. I got like disconnected 4 or 5 times so far.
Racist interference. I'm so glad you persevered and were able to get on.
Yeah, call from another number. But with the postpartum depression report, I don't know if I really believe it. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of black women that are, you know, they have hard times. But is postpartum depression supposed to be some type of disease where you don't bond with the child? Isn't that what it's supposed to be about?
It can be. I don't claim to be an expert. They might have a specific title for that, but it can be. And I think it also can just be a general depression where you just, you know, are feeling anxious or down or unhappy or stressed about what have you. I don't think it necessarily has to be that there's a disruption, but again, I do not claim to be an expert.
Oh, okay. Okay, I thought it was something where you weren't bonded with your baby. Okay, I had to look more into that. I was talking to some family members. There was a lot of family around. I don't want to say I appreciate, you know, the so-called holidays, but I do get a chance to see family members that I haven't seen for a while, at least for a whole year, and a lot of the older people in our family. So I asked them about the Jonestown. How old were they when all that was happening, and were they ever, you know, like, thinking about going? And for the same reason that a lot of people in the reports that you had played said that they went, because he was a white person, a white male that was, you know, sounding good or what he was saying or whatever, that's actually the reason why most of the older people in my family said that it didn't catch on with them, because they said it didn't seem right. They said it seemed like something wasn't quite right about that. A white person supposed to be helping out black people by taking them to some other country, and then he's supposed to be some type of minister. They just said it didn't seem right, so it didn't really like affect them to where they wanted to go. Actually, that made them not wanna go, and it made them question other people that you know were in their generation that maybe were thinking about it or talking about it. Just asking them, like, why would you wanna go with some white man that is basically faking like he's some type of black preacher or something? And so I like talking to older people. I also was talking to them about with the farm. A lot of the older people in my family lived on a farm, and they, you know, the men had to wring chickens' necks, and they had to slaughter pigs, and they had to, you know, kill ducks and stuff. It was for them to eat. And I asked them, how did y'all deal with that? Did y'all feel some type of way where maybe you didn't want to eat you know, you had just seen the chicken earlier that day, and then you murdered the chicken, and you gave it to, you know, grandma or aunt, whoever, to pluck and get it prepared for dinner, and did you eat? And they said it didn't make them not want to eat, that they actually had to kill their own food to eat. And that was an interesting discussion that we had. And I do want to comment on the white terrorists that went to the synagogue and killed the Jewish people. The report said that he is on death row, and then at the end it said, the person said, pending appeal. So does that mean that it's a possibility that terrorist can appeal his way out of death row and possibly off, out of prison? I was just asking. I don't know a lot about legal stuff, but I thought an appeal meant that you can write a letter or something and try to get out of your jail sentence. And that was a question, and thank you for letting me speak. And hello, everybody, if I didn't say hi. And, okay, thanks for letting me speak.
Yes, ma'am. Again, thank you so much for persevering and sharing your thoughts and research. We had a number of folks researching Jonestown. Dr. Welsing would be so proud of you all. That, I think, is outstanding, because you can be around family members, especially older family members, and you don't have to talk to them about white supremacy directly, per se. The same way that I think others have said you can bring up justice sometimes. If they're older, you can just be asking them about their life and different events. Where were you when this happened? What were you doing? What did you think about this? What did you think about that? Like, and be learning a lot about racism, white supremacy, but you're not talking about it directly. And it's giving them an opportunity to maybe to talk and think about some events or episodes that they haven't thought about in 15, 20, 30 years, maybe longer sometimes. So I think that's awesome all the way around. Outstanding. With the question in terms of the appeal, as I understand it, generally with an appeal, you are at least saying that there is a problem. Either that, you know, there needs to be a new trial, that, you know, there needs to be a re-examination of the facts. There is a problem. Maybe it's a problem so big that I should be released, or at minimum should have a new trial. But there is a problem. Potentially something was not done correctly in me ending up here behind these bars, generally with an appeal. Could mean a lot of things. You have to see where it goes. It's not kind of final until they say all the appeals have been exhausted or denied, or sometimes that'll be a part of the sentence, no opportunity for appeal. But once that's been exhausted, then it's, you know, all right, you're going to be there for, you know, whatever your sentence is. But yeah, if he has an appeal, then at least he is trying to see if he can get out or something, get a new trial, something, get some assistance, get asking for help, no shame. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, I guess if you have reports from the so-called holiday, particularly if you were able to make it constructive, you were able to have some sort of exchange, and there was no ugliness, no name calling, it was constructive, that'd probably be good too. But others, any folks that we missed at all, definitely make sure you get your hand up sooner than later. Don't wait till the last moment. If you have additional comments, questions, feel free.
Have you heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was thinking about that segment. I think they were mentioning Call of Duty, the video game, and I guess they're using that as a recruiting tool, I guess, to recruit young people. And that was the first time I really heard of that one. But there's definitely a lot of younger racists on the Xbox Live Call of Duty. I know that's kind of like an entertainment area, people activity, but definitely they're on the microphone saying racist things. And I did have some conversations about racism that came up during the Thanksgiving Day. I know the first one, my attempted family members were mentioned in the movie Harriet, and my two cousins, black males, one was saying, he asked, did you go and see the movie? And he said, yeah, he saw it. He said he thought it was good. And the other cousin was like, man, them white boys made you mad, huh? And he got serious VGQ. So he was saying, you know what? What people didn't know is there were a lot of, you know, good white folks back then, and they got hanged too and everything. So I didn't say anything. But another portion of it was we ended up talking about the racism at the University of Florida, how they won't play quarterbacks. And we was talking about Lamar Jackson and how we think that racism was being practiced and how he ended up going to Louisville. And also, it came up again with, I believe my uncle, I was told, was lynched downtown. And I asked what his name was, and she was saying she said his name, and they were saying that I guess it was because he was going around killing white folks on a horse or something like that. And my aunt says, well, hey, you know, she says she didn't blame him because when you're going around raping women and stealing our land, this this is what's going to happen. So it's a tendency for racism to come up, I've noticed. I don't know, maybe it's a dynamic where we're just sitting in front of the television and it just happens like that in my experience. And also one of my cousins, he congratulated me on getting a degree at the community college. And he said his cousin was going to go for African-American studies. So that's how a lot of my interactions went on Thanksgiving. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. The racism is right there. You don't even have to bring it up. They'll bring it up. The Lamar Jackson, almost every time I hear someone, because I said I was watching Lamar Jackson on Monday, and the white woman came in and started talking about racism. She wasn't even talking about Lamar Jackson. She was just talking about racism, and I was trying to watch him. But generally, every time his name comes up, I hear something about racism, where people were saying he's a candidate to win MVP, right? Lamar Jackson plays in the NFL. He won a Heisman, went to University of Louisville for college. But they said, yeah, he's looking like he's going to run away. Or that's a metaphor. Looks like he is going to be the prohibitive winner of the MVP, meaning that it doesn't look like there's any competition. He has been had that stellar of a season. And they said, can you believe it? The number of white people who didn't even think he could play quarterback. Could be workplace racism. Forget Kaepernick. I thought this is a much better illustration of workplace racism, that he's done this well, could be the best player in the league this season. And they, in fact, they even had a white person who come out and said, wow, I had an idea of a quarterback, and it wasn't this here black fella. And there were a number of commentators who said his idea was a white man, not this here black fella with all this curly hair. That's why he couldn't see, wow, Lamar Jackson could be the best player in the league. Like, my goodness. But yeah, that would be an easy one. If you're in Florida, like, oh my goodness, did you see what they did at the University of Florida? Did you see what they did to Willie Taggart at FSU? I don't like them either, but did you see what they did to him? I think that could be another one. Like, you just go on for days, just talking. And then the uncle story, that's why I said, like, just knowing what happened to our own family, like, it doesn't necessarily have to be that intense every time. Hopefully it won't be. But I mean, I think would be amazed just knowing about our own family situations with regards to racism, white supremacy. That is, yeah, I would want the name. I try to get his name. You work at the courthouse. So, I mean, yeah, if you could get a name, you could probably do lots of researching. Let's see. Oh, yeah, there was one thing I was going to add. In terms of a firearm, in a system of racism, white supremacy, sometimes white people do not allow black people to have firearms. Sometimes they have made laws at times, specifically restricting black people's access to firearms. So sometimes white people may not allow you to observe that part of your code. Not saying it's anything bad or incorrect about it, but just those are, unless I'm misinformed, those are the logics, the facts of this here problem. Other folks, if you have additional comments, questions, you want to make sure you get in. We have a little over 10 minutes left in the program. Please don't wait until the final second. If you think you have a comment or question to share, *61. If you would like to participate, again, we'll be here in about 24 hours. Azor Savage, you failed us. I might be cool enough to get my phone, see if I can find some of the cool notes that I took from her book. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in? Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving. Yes, sir. Thomas in New York, I think that was.
Oh, no, it's me. I'm losing my voice. Yeah, I sound like a man.
Sorry. Hello. Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
It's all good. It's all good. It's just I was told a long time ago by a white female when I took theater that she said that I had a gurgly type voice like Phyllis Diller. So I guess I sound like Phyllis Diller tonight, or a man, depending on who's listening. So pardon that. I just wanted to comment. I think it's a caller in Florida said something about recruitment, racist recruitment. I've been driving and seeing a lot more recruitment for the Marines again. I hadn't, not that I was looking for it, but I do pay attention to billboards and stuff because I work sometimes in graphic design. That's what I went to school for, but I've been seeing a lot of that. So I guess it's, you could say racist codification. One way or another, they're going to get white people armed for whatever conflicts they have in mind, whether they're political and government declared or paramilitary, covert, you know, racist operations. And I'll mute my line. Thanks. Have a good night.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to make, I just don't recall, I've been watching this young brother playing football. And I'm seeing some of the racism behind them. I don't recall seeing the same thing with Patrick Mahomes, who was just won the MVP last year. He has a white parent and a white wife. Even Colin Kaepernick didn't get this type of treatment. Or Russell Wilson, who kind of, he's black, but he could be construed as a non-black, non-white person. But Lamar Jackson is getting the same treatment. I kind of could attribute to Michael Vick, minus the felony charges that you know they dug up on him. So I'm just seeing that this is an obvious black person. Like it's not a half black person, half white person, or any other mixture, and he's getting the treatment because this is a position that they would like to keep white. I just thought that was interesting. Also, with the brother in Florida said about the video games, Tom Clancy has a set of video games, a whole bunch of games to do all kinds of missions or these war-type missions. And it was an article that came out maybe 3 years ago where they were showing how the military was recruiting using, in particular, his games. In fact, they were behind making the games, funding this game, and they were funding it and making the games to do specific tasks that they wanted people to do. So the people who were at the top of the game were given military positions, just playing the game every day for entertainment purposes. One of those missions in particular was flying the drones, because all the drones that's flown that the military flies, they fly from bases in Nevada. So from all the way there, they're controlling a drone in Afghanistan. Based off the fact that they're used to playing the game, they said they won't have an emotional connection to the targets because it's just like the game. You know, you're just blowing up they look like people, but they're not real. And that's pretty much how they, you know, they take the mindset of using the drones. So they are using that.
Much obliged. I think there is a movie that came out some time ago with Matthew Broderick called War Games, where the military, they have like a chi, or they have like a really kind of primitive video game, and they bring in people who are good at bringing children, white children who are good at this game, and it's the same, like basically what you're talking about. Same type of thing. You'd be doing the same thing and you have no emotional attachment because it's almost like you're playing a game, but it's real. You're dropping bombs and that type of thing. So they've had this concept is not new, even though the Call of Duty, I don't know what version they're on, but even within that scheme, this is kind of old. Racists do a lot of the same things over and over and over. Was that Ivy?
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I actually I emailed a friend of mine, and I was speaking with him with the email with a lot of different things. But I mentioned the horror day of Thanksgiving. I haven't heard back from him yet. This was just not too long ago that I emailed him. But what I said to him is, I told him, I said, I don't celebrate Thanksgiving. I said Abraham Lincoln declared it a day of Thanksgiving for white supremacy. And I said, white people are commemorating white supremacy in a slick way. I said, like they do with terrorists on money and statues, and they want to distract from their crimes with turkey and religion.
Turkey.
Yeah. And I had a question for you. I'm kind of conflicted about this. What I have been doing before is that I want to buy stuff on Black Friday or Cyber Monday or anything, or even Thanksgiving or whenever they have, or Christmas or any of that stuff, when they have, you know, these discounts and things like that, because it's rooted in white supremacy. And like, for example, for Black Friday, that's when they enslaved black people and they sold them for a discount, and they are, you know, commemorating that, and they're trying to also distract from that fact of history, you know, with discounts and sales and things of that nature. Just being underhanded, I was about to say slick, which is a metaphor probably, just like they're doing, you know, with Thanksgiving. But at the same time, if you know, you have to buy things and you need things, and if you don't buy them on the day that they have the discounts and things of that nature, you'll be paying more. And, of course, the discounts are not every day, so you're going to still be paying more or whatever. But I'm saying if you buy stuff on those particular days, you will pay less for those particular items that you may get. And so I wanted to know what your opinion was and your take is in terms of, you know, not really wanting to buy on those days because you know you don't want to support any of that or any of that, but at the same time you also don't want to spend more when you can spend less and give the white people less money for the things that you do have to buy from them, because you do have to buy something from them. So, yeah, that was it.
It's a good question. Good question. I think being with time and energy, that's a huge portion of counter-racism, or should be. I think if you already said this is not like splurging, and I'm just going to buy, you know, little knickknacks, and, you know, I just want to get, I don't know, a polka dot elephant to hang on the wall just because it looks goofy and it's going to be 75% off because it's Nigger Friday. This is not that. These are things that you would need to purchase anyway. And if they have a bonus, I would say, yeah, that's great. Take advantage. If we were talking about toilet paper, things that you know you're going to use anyway, things that you cook with, things that you use around the house, light bulbs, things that you know I'm going to use this. If I'm alive for the next 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is, even 6 months, I think I'm going to use light bulbs over that time. I think, you know, soap or whatever it is. Yeah, I think that's constructive. If these things are discounted over the next week or month or whatever, because of the so-called holiday, and you can save a few nickels, grand. I think some whites encourage that sort of shopping to look out that you can get great deals this time of year, that if you're in, you are shopping for certain things that you would need to get anyway, this can be a good time to do some shopping because they'll have a lot of deals. And I think sometimes, especially if you wait till after White Jesus's birthday, they have even more sometimes. So be thrifty, save those nickels. That's a big part of counter racism. We have about 30 seconds. Any final comments before we conclude, or everyone satisfied?
Yeah, Gus, I advocate shopping on Black Friday. I don't think not shopping on Black Friday is going to be a protest to white supremacy. I hear that a lot from black people. But, I mean, you're telling the poorest and most underprivileged people in the country to not shop on a day that the stuff is the cheapest. That just makes no sense. And what I usually do is I if I want a computer or a television or something big, I wait for that day, save up my money, and that's the day I get it, because I'm going to get free shipping and I'm going to get it dirt cheap. I know that's a metaphor.
Ooh, made me change up. My goodness, I had a page from Azura Savage, her book that I was going to read, but since she'll be with us tomorrow, I guess I can read it then. I already had this page in the Word Guide. I meant to read this before, and I didn't. Now, look at here. Neely Fuller Jr., page 92, dirt cheap, underlined. Do not use this term. Do not use terms like dirty book, dirty look, dirty name, dirty talk, dirty woman, dirty words, etc. when others use the term dirt cheap. Ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Is dirt cheap? How important is dirt? If dirt is a source that supports nourishment, is it correct to say that dirt is cheap? Note, during the existence of white supremacy racism, dirt is thought of as being dark, and being dark, like non-white people, both dirt and non-white people are generally thought of as worthless. One of the reasons I often say with those metaphors, generally, they are transporting concepts, notions of white supremacy racism. Clear as snow, cream of the crop, generally the metaphors. Dark day, generally they are supporting racism, white supremacy, dirt cheap. Thank you for the reminder. I neglected reading that. Neely Fuller Jr.'s Word Guide, producejustice.com. We should be here tomorrow, but we are 30 minutes late. I'm teaching yoga and then running from my mat to come and do the broadcast. Azura Savage should be with us discussing his book. We'll have to make sure with the pronouns. You failed us. I had a page. I pulled it up to read, and then I'll have to wait and read it tomorrow. But I'll be all set to go because I'll know, bam, I already have the page pulled up. You failed us, talking about white supremacy racism in the Seattle public schools. 8:30, 30 minutes late. 8:30 Eastern, 5:30 Pacific, Sunday afternoon. Much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. We should be here in about 24 hours. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy for the entire so-called holiday season. I think we would be best. Let's stay sober so we don't have to worry about getting stopped while we are out and about. Keep our brain computers working at their best. In addition to being sober, let's make sure we're buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver, doing all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being buckled up and sober, if you are driving, not on the cell phone, just doing all the little things to keep ourselves as safe as we can under conditions designed to be dangerous. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.